Portions of the day's programming are reproduced by means of electrical transcriptions or tape recordings.
Testing, testing, hot out, brown cow, 1, 2, 3, 4, testing.
Hey, boss, you know, Ralph, I'm getting a little nervous out here. I don't know how you can keep so calm back there.
Get ready. 10 seconds. 5 seconds. Go.
Hey, I can't find nothing on the radio. Yo, turn to that station.
Your one definition of a friend is someone who's there when you need him. Well, I needed him and he's here. Ladies and gentlemen, my friend Elton
Jim.
Good morning, Elton Jim.
Elton Jim.
The one, the only, Elton Jim Toronto.
I'm back. Elton Jim Toronto with you here at WGN 720 AM in Chicago. Filling in for Nick DiGilio. Be here until 5 AM, just like we were yesterday. I was among the first to wish you a happy 4th of July yesterday morning. Let me be one of the first to welcome you to July 5th and say, how was your 4th of July? Producer Dan Long, how was your 4th of July?
All in all, pretty good. I got no complaints here.
Did you do anything or did you just hang out?
Just had a little family cookout type thing.
And so yesterday, if you listened to the program, the whole program was dedicated to an historical appreciation and information sharing about Independence Day and the 4th of July. So, Dan, I ask you, because one of the things I said, the purpose of the show was not to, denigrate the fact that you will be going to parties and being cornholed, playing bags and things like that, but that, hey, you can actually go to these parties and different events and impress your family and friends with some of the information and the facts that we discussed on the show yesterday. So I ask you, Dan, because you actually were a part of the show and you were a part of, the process of finding the information. Did you impart any of the knowledge that that we talked about and impressed family and friends at your get together?
I did not cornhole, and I did not get a chance to whip out any facts, any U.S. Constitution or Declaration.
There were two double entendres right in a row. Let me just say, welcome to the show. Now I'm a happy man, and once again, to accent those. Say those again so I can then do my little bit on that. You did what?
I did not get a chance to cornhole, and I did not whip anything out.
Oh, we miss you, Charles Nelson Reilly. So, yeah, you did not cornhole and you did not what?
Did not whip out any facts.
Wow, nice one. You see what he did there, folks? Did you hear that? Believe me, there'll be more of that. It's only 12 after 1. We're here till 5. There'll be enough double entendres and holes to get your fill. But you did not impart. Now, you didn't mention anything about the 18th Amendment, for instance, which we talked about. You didn't mention anything about, the Boston Tea Party or taxation without representation. You didn't drop into the conversation the name of Patrick Henry or Thomas Paine. None of that.
No, none of that. That kind of stuff has to happen organically, I think. I just didn't get the chance.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm a little disappointed. I'm going to tell you that.
Well, I would like to get my Constitution test graded history teacher.
Yeah, Dan and I took found this practice Constitution test online, and so we took it. But unfortunately, there was only one thing missing: some really good questions. The only thing that was missing was the answer key, which I realized soon into the test. It's really important to have an answer key when you have a test. Especially when there's 85 or so questions and you don't know all the answers. But we still had a good time. And I have to remember that our friend Daryl from yesterday, He nailed 6 out of 6 questions. One
he
of the
did
callers,
pretty well, yeah.
I mean, I once again, I asked, you know, the honor system of all days, 4th of July, show some honor. No Googling, you know, no outside, no call a friend, no lifelines. But Daryl knocked him dead 6 for 6, so that was impressive. So, and we didn't do too bad. We went over some of the questions, and we seemed to be on the same track. So, as I said, at least, I don't know if they would have kicked us out of the country. I think we did enough on the Constitution test to stay here, but they probably would have at least given us a security guard just to keep an eye on us.
Don't get pulled over, right?
Yeah, we didn't do that well. We did okay. Although you did, I mean, you finished the whole test. I only did a few of them. You actually did all, did you do all 85 questions?
Yeah, I finished the whole thing.
Wow.
You were hosting a show, though.
I did have time. I mean, I found the test like 4 days before, so I could have done it. But anyway, so we, my 4th of July was rather uneventful. I, as I said before, I hate to just talk about the weather all the time when it is this hot. But if you've listened to me with any regularity, you know that I'm really not a hot weather kind of guy. And so the last several days just have not been fun. I went outside for a little while and I said, holy schvitz. You know, wow, it was so hot. It felt like a sauna. I was expecting, when I was walking in my yard, I was expecting to see someone hand me a towel. It was just like, welcome to the sauna bath. But, so just uneventful. We had a few, I guess I would say random fireworks in the neighborhood, a few things popping here and there. Watched the TV show from Washington, D.C., where they had some cool fireworks. John Stamos hosted a show there. And then I watched the Macy's in New York. They really do an amazing job in New York. There's like 5 or 6 barges. I don't know if that's the Hudson River or where, what body of water they have the barges in for the New York fireworks. But it's pretty impressive. Now, my question is, if Macy's can sponsor the New York fireworks display, which is very impressive, as I said before, it's just like, wow, then why can't Macy's here in Chicago do the same thing and give us? And don't get me wrong, I watched the Channel 9 with Dean Richards, as I talked to you before. Poor Dean got drenched right after the fireworks ended. He was on live TV, and the heavens opened up and baptized everyone with a downpour, including Dean and his beautiful straw fedora, which I think was a casualty of the storm. But the Chicago fireworks were very nice, but they weren't like New York's. And we have a Macy's here, and if I recall, there has been, at least initially, when Macy's took over for Marshall Field several years ago, there was a lot of PR problems. People wanted Marshall Fields to come back. So I would have thought that Macy's would have been a nice corporate citizen here in Chicago and maybe, you know, throw a little little party for us on 4th of July. But I guess not. Anyway, it was hope you had a good 4th, and here we are at the 5th. So once again, that's over. That's that's taillights. And we look forward to the next several months, and as I said, I'm looking forward to October when it's back to 50 degrees again. Whew. So what's on the docket? Oh, what I have to say is, yeah, you know what, you could talk about one of the reasons why I didn't go out. It's not really the real reason, but I'll pretend it is. You may have had your nice parties with your picnics and your corn and your potato salad and your hamburgers and your hot dogs. But speaking of hot dogs, for me, the big story of the day, there were two stories of the day, I would think, today. And one was this woman who climbed up on the Statue of Liberty. Did you see those pictures? She was protesting. She wanted to abolish ICE, the whole immigration thing. So she made a statement. Somehow she climbed up the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty and got beneath Lady Liberty's sandal. And sort of camped out there for about 3 or 4 hours and sort of set the first responders and the New York police abuzz. And she was eventually taken down. But that was certainly interesting. And all of Ellis, all of Liberty Island had to be closed. And I mean, didn't anybody tell her that, you know, there are stairs inside the statue? You don't have to crawl, you don't have to scale the outside. She was over there, you know, grabbing on Lady Liberty's robes there. No, you can go inside and climb up and go all the way to the crown. You don't have to. You don't have to scale it on the outside. It's almost like she was in some kind of a, you know, Alfred Hitchcock movie. But for me, the real story happened in New York. And if you didn't see it, you certainly should have, because to me, this is a yearly event. I watch it all the time on 4th of July. It was the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest from Coney Island. And there was controversy this year. There's never a hot dog contest that is not without controversy. And so this year's, of course, was certainly one that will go down in the record books for a couple of reasons, because there is this professional eater, this competitive eater named Joey Chestnut, Joey Jaws Chestnut. And he has apparently won this now 11 years in a row. And I've been watching this for a good 10 or 15 years now. They have it on ESPN every year. It's on at about 11 o'clock in the morning on 4th of July from Nathan's at Coney Island, which is the Nathan's is one of the famous New York hot dog places. On Coney Island, and they have this hot dog eating contest with all this competitive eating. And this guy, Joey Chestnut, is the far and away, I mean, he's the Babe Ruth of competitive eating, or at least at Nathan's. And he broke the world record for hot dogs and bun, or HDB, as it is referred to in the competitive eating world. HDB, hot dog and bun. And he scarfed, and I think that's the only word you can use, he scarfed down 74 hot dogs and buns. And if you ever seen this happen, it's quite a feat. I think in the matter of 10 minutes, he downs like 2,000 calories of these of hot dogs and buns. And the way he does it, I mean, there is an art to this. He eats the hot dogs, and today he was eating two at a time, shoving them in his mouth, and then he takes the bun and wets the bun so that it disintegrates and then eats the bun. You have to have the bun as well as the hot dog. You don't have to eat them at the same time, but you do have to ingest the hot dogs and the buns. And which way you can do that, you are allowed to, as long as you have the hot dog and the bun. But here's the crazy thing that happened. So I've been watching this for several years, and it is kind of a weird oddity to watch. It's one of those things like it's a car wreck. It's so gross, but you still want to take a look at it. And so he's, you know, just shoving these hot dogs and these soaked buns into his mouth. It's not very appetizing to watch. But so they have these people that are counting, because you know, this is the whole thing. There's a whole stage filled of at least 10 or 15 people that are competing. And he wins almost every year. He's only one year in the last several he lost. I think he lost in 2015, and now he's won the last couple again. But apparently the judges, so when the 10 minutes is over, they said he ate 64 hot dogs and bun, HDB. Well, then, almost as they're going, they said there might be a discrepancy here. It seems as if the judges have miscounted. And sure enough, he ate 10 more hot dogs than they initially counted. And that 10 more makes it 74, and that became the new world record for HDB, hot dog and bun. So there was controversy this year. Not in the winter at all. Joey Chestnut, once again, going away. But there was controversy, and the controversy came out in his favor, in that he ate 10 more hot dogs than they had initially given him credit for. And those 10 extra hot dogs allowed him to break the world record. So today, July 4th, 2018, I mean, write this down, folks. You were alive for this. You were around. Someday your grandkids or your great-grandkids or many years in the future, you could say, I was around when Joey Jaws Chestnut ate 74 hot dogs and set a new world record. Oh, you got to love 4th of July. And you got to love being on the radio here at 720 WGN. I'm Jim Toronto filling in for Nick DiGilio. We will be back right after this message, so there's no switching. Hey, it's Jim Toronto here filling in for Nick DiGilio. Be here till 5 a.m. And I think who do we pass it on to today? Do we pass it on to Justin Kaufman or Or Steve Cochran or Dave Plyer?
Yeah, it'll be Justin Kaufman is in for
Steve. Steve.
Actually, I think because it's a business day, so we'll have the opening bell.
Oh, so the opening bell will be on at 5. I see. Because yesterday we didn't have that. Or today. What was it? Yesterday, officially. So we will do the opening bell at 5, and then Justin will be filling in for Steve Cochran. Is that what it is? Okay, cool. But anyway, we are here until 5. Hopefully you are going to be with us for the duration. As I've said many times, I'm going to be here. I'm here. I'm staying up till 5. Why can't you? Please do. Just settle in. Find your comfortable chair. Get one of your favorite beverages. Even turn the lights out, but just keep the radio on. Keep it tuned to 7:20 a.m. And we'll have fun together for the next, 3.5 hours or so? So I hope you will stay tuned. And on the other side of the news, yesterday we played a few, as we talked about different things in history, one of the little segments that I played throughout the show were those very famous from the 70s, the Schoolhouse Rock little story lesson songs of America rock, about the preamble, about No More Kings, you know, these different little history lessons in song. And what I wanted to do was several weeks ago, actually a couple of months ago now, the composer of many or most of those songs from the Schoolhouse Rock series, and there was America Rock, there was Grammar Rock, there was Science Rock. Once they were proven to be very popular as part of the Saturday morning cartoon block that ABC had, then they expanded their sites. But it started out as a way for kids to learn their multiplication tables. And the composer's name was Bob Duro, and he passed away several months ago at age 94. And I just wanted to give him a little tribute, because for those of you who were around, grew up in the early to mid-70s, and you watched cartoons on Saturday morning, you knew Schoolhouse Rock, and you knew Conjunction Junction, and I'm Only a Bill, and naughty Number 9, and all these different things. So I thought we could give Mr. Duro his due respect and attention and remember him, and also hear some of those great songs. So at the other side of the news, we will do that. So stay tuned for that and a whole lot more, as I said, taking you through until 5 a.m., filling in for Nick DiGilio. I just found out that it's his birthday coming up. So happy birthday to Nick. Jim Toronto with you here at WGN, 7:20 a.m. in Chicago, filling in for Nick DiGilio. Be here till 5 a.m. Hope you will stay along for the ride. I mean, what are you doing? If you're listening to me right now, then what else do you have to do? Where are you going? Stick around. We'll have a little fun until 5 a.m. and beyond here at WGN. So as I was saying, yeah, we played a few of these yesterday, but there were some that some very well-known little Schoolhouse Rock vignettes that we didn't get a chance to play because they didn't really fit in with the theme of 4th of July. But I did want to recognize this performer and this songwriter. His name was Bob Duro. And once again, you probably have never heard that name, and I was a big fan of these, and I never knew this guy's name. But he recently passed away at age 94, and when I saw the obituary, it was one of those nostalgic moments when you sort of take a step back, because, as I said, anybody who grew up in the 70s will certainly remember Schoolhouse Rock, and these things have lived on, and they're all on YouTube, and I think there was even a live show featuring a lot of these songs, because they were initially written 3 minutes long to teach a lesson about either math or grammar or history. And they were part of the Schoolhouse Rock program. And then within that, there were subcategories. There was America Rock, so that was about history. And there was Multiplication Rock, and obviously that was about your multiplication tables. And there was Grammar Rock, about your nouns and your verbs and your adjectives and your conjunctions. You may know that. many of us don't even know, probably remember what a conjunction is in terms of a grammatical, well, I don't know what the word is here, part of grammar. Because of this song, because of Conjunction Junction, these 3-minute little songs that taught you a lesson, but they were catchy songs, they were memorable songs. As I said many times yesterday, the preamble to the Constitution, one from America Rock, I sang that in my mind when I was doing my Constitution test. The one about how a bill becomes a law. I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, I mean, I was singing that in my head when I was in eighth grade to make sure I got all the steps right. And so once again, these things were meant to entertain, but they're also there to teach. And job well done. Because they did. 40 some years later, and those songs are still ingrained in many of our minds, those of us who watch the Saturday morning cartoons on ABC. And the funny thing is how this whole thing came together. So apparently a network executive at ABC was talking to somebody, and he was kind of, you know, half joking and complaining, and this is in the late 60s, early 70s, sort of complaining to a friend of his and saying, oh, you know, my kids know all the words to these Rolling Stones songs, but they don't know their multiplication tables. And so the person that he was talking to said, well, you know, it's actually not it's an interesting idea. You know, I know this this performer, this jazz, and Bob Duro was a jazz performer. He wasn't very popular. He wasn't a big hit, but I guess he was a very, you know, well known within the industry as a very good songwriter and a good performer. And so someone said, "Well, if you want to write if they can know the words to the songs, maybe they could put multiplication tables to music, and that's how they can learn it." So this germ of an idea began to get some legs, and so someone suggested that they contact this jazz performer, Bob Duro, and they threw him the idea, and I guess within a couple of days, he came back with a prototype with a song about the multiplication tables for the threes, your threes, you know, your three times threes and your three times fours, and they liked it enough to give it a shot, so then they animated them with a cartoon to go along with the song. And they put him on, and suddenly it was an immediate hit. And so then he did everything from like 0 to 12. I don't think he did ones, because the ones are too easy. but he did all 12. You know, he went, because those are the main multiplication tables we all learned, 1 through 12, right? And then after those became a hit, then they said, well, what else can we do? These seem to be catching on, and kids are learning through this. So then, like I said, they got into history. They got into grammar. They got into science. But it all started with this one, your multiplication tables for the number three.
Is a magic number. Yes, it is. It's a magic number. Somewhere in the ancient mystic trinity, you get three as a magic number. The past and the present and the future, faith and hope and charity, the heart and the brain and the body give you three as a magic number. It takes three legs to make a tripod or to make a table stand. It takes three wheels to make a vehicle called a tricycle. Every triangle has three corners. Every triangle has three sides. No more, no less. You don't have to guess. When it's three, you can see it's a magic number. A man and a woman had a little baby. Yes, they did. They had three in the family. That's a magic number. 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18.
21, 24, 27, 30, 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18, 21, 24, 27, 30.
Multiply backwards from 3 times 10.
3 times 10 is 30. 3 times 9 is 27. 3 times 8 is 24. 3 times 7 is 21. 3 times 6 is 18. 3 times 5 is 15. 3 times 4 is 12. 3 times 3 is 9. 2 times 2 is 6. And 3 times 1 is 3, of course.
And that is how you started to learn your multiplication tables of 3, thanks to Bob Duro. And right now, I haven't heard that one in a long time, for years, and all of a sudden, that came right back to me. I knew it again. And one of my other favorite ones, even though I think the, if you remember when you learned your multiplication tables way back when, the easiest ones were like your 2s and your 5s, because 5s only had zeros and 5s. So, you know, once you got, and it was always just add 5 to the 0 and add another 5 to the 5, you get the 0 again. So those are always easy. But the 5 song from Schoolhouse Rock was kind of fun, too. So I thought we could play that one. Here's the multiplication tables of 5, according to Schoolhouse Rock.
5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, 55, 60, 65, 70, 75, 80, 85, 90, 95, 100, ready, not, here I come. Apple, peaches, pumpkin pie. Who's not ready? Holler, I. All right, I'll count it again, but you better get hit, kid. Here we go. 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, 55, 60, 65, 70, 75, 80, 85, 90, 95, 100, 105, 110, 115, 120, there, a bushel of wheat and a bushel of rye, who's not here, holler, I, 20 nickels makes a dollar, I didn't hear anybody holler, 5 times 20 is 100, everybody got to be hit, all eyes open, here I come.
And as you can see, you know, what was so neat about these songs too was that they were all different types of songs and different kind of genres of music. So even though Bob Duro was a jazz aficionado and a jazz performer and a jazz writer, you know, he went across all different kinds of musical genres. Once again, to change things up, to make these catchy little tunes that would stick in your mind and help you learn your multiplication tables. And I never had problems with my multiplication table, so I don't know how much I learned from this in terms of actually learning them. But I remember these songs, and there was, like I said, there was the figure eight. Then you skate a figure eight. And then there was naughty number 9. And I don't think he did 10 either, because 10s were too easy. But they went all the way, you know, from, I think, from 0. He didn't do 1 and 10, but did 0 to 12. And but that number 3 one, the first one we played, debuted in 1973. And they were on for most of the 70s, I think, into the early 80s as well. As I said, they spanned a lot of different genres. Now, do... which one's the next one we have there, Dan? Oh, so, yeah. So, conjunction. So, now they went into grammar. And, I mean, this one is a classic. This has got this bluesy kind of feel to it. It's just a great song. And in the middle, you learn what a conjunction is. Hooking up words and making them function. So, here's a little conjunction junction. How's that function?
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
Hooking up words and phrases and clauses.
Conjunction, junction, how's that function?
I got 3 favorite cards that get most of my job done.
Conjunction, junction, what's their function?
I got and, but, and, or, they'll get you pretty far. And, that's an additive, like this and that. Sort of the opposite, not this, but that. And then there's or, O-R, when you have a choice like this or that. And but and or, get you pretty,
bring it home!
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
Hooking up 2 boxcars, making them run right. Milk and honey, bread and butter,
peas and rice.
Hey, that's nice.
Dirty but happy, digging and scratching, losing your shoe and a button or two. He's poor but honest, sad but true. Boo-hoo-hoo-hoo!
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
Looking up two cards to one when you say something like this.
I mean, come on, what a great song this is. Conjunction, junction, how's that function gonna get you there if you're very careful? So Bob Doro passed away a few months ago at age 94, responsible for many of the songs. There were some other, as the series continued and they branched out, other people did write some of the songs as well, but Bob Doro was the first and wrote many of the of those memorable ones, of course. And I think maybe after the break we'll play one or two more just to jog your memory and get a little misty-eyed for those of you who were there. And if not, go online and check these out. Just hit Schoolhouse Rock on YouTube, and they'll all come up. And you have to just really appreciate the songwriting and of how they were bringing in, concepts of lessons in the midst of a catchy tune. And listen to that music there. That's well produced. These were not just thrown together. Those were those were pretty solid productions of music songs, regardless of what their topics were. So they obviously invested a lot of money, as I said before, too. They also were animated, so it wasn't just a song because these were on television. So if you were around in the 70s, I know that you enjoyed Schoolhouse Rock. If you weren't, go back and go on YouTube and discover these, because they really are really something cool. Orangutans, giraffes, and bears. Oh, my. Get up close and personal with colorful wildlife and wild destinations. Cruisin' Indiana is tonight on WGN-TV News at 9. It is about 1:48. I'm Jim Tarano filling in for Nick DiGilio. We'll be back right after this little message here, so no switching. Jim Tarano back with you here at WGN, 720 AM, filling in for Nick DiGilio this morning. So as I said, I wanted to just give some due respect and honor somebody who I think played an important role in my childhood and a lot of people's childhoods. If you grew up in the 70s, around 1973, Schoolhouse Rock first debuted on ABC TV. And it really was a very helpful teaching tool for many of us to learn our multiplication tables and to learn about history and to learn about science and to learn about grammar. And we just played the great Conjunction Junction song about the conjunctions like and but and things like that. And there's a couple more that I'd like to just play just because these really, when I was doing a little research on this and I pulled these up and listened to them, I was like, wow. All the words came back to me. All of the images of the animation for these songs came back to me. As I said, they were played on Saturday morning in between the commercials and the cartoons for the cartoon block on Saturday morning. There used to be on every station, every network, would have cartoons every Saturday morning from about 8 or 9 o'clock till about 11 o'clock or noon. Just one cartoon after another, and you would just be flipping around different stations. But on ABC. In between all that cartoon hilarity of the Harlem Globetrotters cartoon and the Wacky Racers with Dick Dastardly and Muttley and some of the other ones, they had Schoolhouse Rock. So here's one about the noun from Grammar Rock, which always caught my ear, from the great Bob Doro.
Every person you can know, and every place that you can go, and anything that you can show, they're nouns. A noun's a special kind of word. It's any name you ever heard. I find it quite interesting. A noun's a person, place, or thing. Oh, I took a train to another state. The flora and the fauna that I saw were really great. Saw some bandits chasing the train. I was wishing I was back home again. I took a train to another state. Well, every person you can know, like a bandit or an engineer, and every place that you can go, like a state or a home, and anything that you can show, like animals and plants or a train.
They're nouns. A noun's a special... Oops.
Oh, Mrs.
Jones is a lady on Hudson Street. She sent her dog to bark at my brother and me. We gave her dog a big fat
bone, and now he barks at Mrs. Jones.
She's a lady who lives on Hudson Street. Well, every person you can know, Mrs. Jones, a lady or a brother, and every place that you can go, like a street or a corner, and anything that you can show, like a dog or a bone.
You know they're nouns. A noun's a special... Oops, oops. Oh, I keep blowing that one. That part that I'm getting wrong is going to come up. Trust me, folks.
We took an early ferry. Went for a walk on the island, you know, and in the middle of summer it started to snow.
Oh,
and I took a ferry to the Statue of Liberty.
Okay, now it's coming up.
Well, every person you can know, like a friend or the captain of a ship, and every place that you can go, an island or a sea, and anything that you can show, like a statue.
Okay, here we go now. You know they're nouns. Oh, again? Oh, okay, I'm not waiting anymore. It goes. A noun's a special kind of word. It's any name you ever heard. I find it quite interesting. A noun's a person, place, or thing. And that's how you knew that a noun was a person, place, or thing. Doodle-doodle-doot. And the last one is probably, in terms of the grammar rock, is probably, I mean, Conjunction Junction is a classic, and that probably is my favorite, but a close second is the one for interjections.
When Reginald was home with flu, the doctor knew just what to do. He cured the infection
with one small injection, and Reginald shouted out, interjections.
Hey, that's smart! Ouch, that hurts! Yeah, that's not fair, giving a guy a shot down there!
Interjections, hey, no excitement,
yeah,
or emotion.
Ouch.
Generally set apart
from a sentence by an explanation point or by a comma when the feeling's not as strong. So when... Oops. I know too much of this.
Geraldine played hard
to get.
Geraldo knew he'd woo her.
Yet.
He showed his affection
despite her objections. And
Geraldine
shouted some interjections.
Well, you've got some nerve. Oh, I've never been so insulted in all my life. Hey, you're kind of cute.
Interjection.
Well,
or emotion.
Hey.
Generally set
apart from a sentence by an explanation point or by a comma when the feeling's not as strong. So when you're happy, hooray! Or sad, aw, or frightened,
eek!
Or mad, rats!
Or excited,
row!
Or glad,
hey!
An interjection sets the sentence right. Da da dun dun. Ah, interjection. Ah, Schoolhouse Rock. Ah, Bob Duro, the songwriter for many of the memorable Schoolhouse Rock songs from the 70s, passed away recently at age 94. Bob, thank you so much for helping me not only on my multiplication tables and my grammar and my constitution test for sure with I'm Just a Bill, but... for some great music and great songs, as well as some great lessons. Bob Duro, we remember you, and we thank you for your talent. I'm Jim Toronto here at WGN 720 AM. I'm filling in for Nick DiGilio. On the other side of the news, we will talk to my friend Mick Kaler, who joins me every so often here when I'm on the radio. We'll be talking about pop culture in the Pop Culture Club segment. And today we're going to be talking about a few different things, but one of the main things is a new look for an old magazine. You may remember several months ago, the news came out that Rolling Stone magazine was being sold. Jan Wenner, who founded the magazine back in 1967 in San Francisco, and it turned into basically an iconic magazine. It was a voice for the generation, definitely of the emerging baby boomers and for the counterculture in the mid to late 60s, and really remained a key barometer and voice for that generation But however, as the decades went on, you have to remember that the counterculture ultimately became the establishment. And Rolling Stone kind of lost its edge. But here we are in 2018. It was recently sold. It was bought. And I got my latest issue in the mail. And I must say, I was a little surprised. So we'll talk about the past, the present, and the potential future for Rolling Stone magazine. Jim Tirano with you here at WGN, 720 AM in Chicago, filling in for Nick DiGilio. Be here till 5 AM. And now we will take a little stroll. We'll go down the stairs, turn the corner, go down a secret hallway, and say the secret word and give the secret handshake, and walk into the Pop Culture Club with one of the founding members, one of the golden card holders of the Pop Culture Club, Mick Kaler. How you doing there, Mick?
I'm doing great, pal. How about yourself?
Very good. Now, explain to the uninitiated why we call this. I'm playing Karma Chameleon as the intro to this segment, and explain why I'm playing Karma Chameleon.
Well, Karma Chameleon is a hit song in the 80s from a group called Culture Club. Culture Club with Boy George, okay? And you and I talk about pop culture.
And oops.
Can you hear me now?
There you go. He's back.
We're a phone commercial. Yeah, we're a Pop Culture Club, as you explained. Culture Club, the band, and we have a little club between us
right.
And our little secret hideaway, as you said, in the basement. We're right past the washing machine and the laundry sink, and we close the door. Girls are allowed, by the way.
That's true. Icky girls are allowed.
That's right. They're icky, but they are allowed.
Yeah, right. But, Mick and I just, we've always been into pop culture, and we met each other back in, my goodness, the mid to early 80s when we both went to Elmhurst College. We were both on the radio station in college. And Mick has gone on to, had a very successful career working with people like Larry Lujack and Robert Murphy and others as a producer. And now you can actually hear his work as a parody songwriter. I was just talking about Bob Duro, who wrote all those Schoolhouse Rock songs. But you are like Bob Duro. You write your own songs that are appearing on a regular basis on the WGN Morning News on Channel 9.
That's right. Me and my buddy Al Flash, every once in a while you hear them talk about something in the news or something we've done for one of the cast members of the show, and they'll say, oh, Mick and Al have a new song for us, and you hear a song and a little video clip, and yeah, we do that as kind of a little side venture to have some fun. Yeah,
very cool. So, and today in the Pop Culture Club, I wanted to talk about a magazine that you and I both grew up reading and enjoying for many years. And that, of course, we were always, and still are, music fans. Although, the older you get, it's harder to be a music fan.
Yeah, it sure is.
And we will be talking about that a little later in this segment as well. But Rolling Stone magazine, which has become an icon unto itself, as I said earlier, first started in San Francisco by Jan Wenner, and really became quickly the voice of the emerging baby boomer, generation, as well as the counterculture that was beginning to develop. Thanks to rock and roll, and thanks to the Vietnam War, and thanks to people talking about the environment, and people talking about drug use, and so there was just this in the tumultuous 60s, there was a counterculture against the establishment, and Rolling Stone conveniently and wisely filled that gap.
It sure did for a long time.
Yeah, and then I think what happened though. As with many kind of rebels, what happens is that the counterculture becomes the establishment. The very thing that they were rebelling against, they eventually become. You know?
Yeah.
And so I think what happened with Rolling Stone, I mean, it had a good run. It certainly when MTV happened and rock music then really became more than just a predicted fad and became established as the music of the generation, and certainly took on a visual aspect. I think Rolling Stone had a pretty good run there. But I would say in the last 15 to 20 years, obviously when the internet came about, many magazines have, the publishing, business in general has been just decimated by the internet because people can just go online as opposed to, holding this hard copy of a magazine. And I think editorially, Rolling Stone kind of lost its way too. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, it did. And in the magazine itself, and you and I have talked about this before, it even shrunk. I mean, it softened and became less vital. I mean, remember the days when the Rolling Stone interview, they would actually say the Rolling Stone interview with Pete Townsend or Bruce Springsteen or even Madonna or John Lennon, whoever it was, that was a big deal, and it became less of a big deal. And the magazine itself actually shrunk. I remember the last time I saw Rolling Stone on the newsstand, it literally looked like the size of an Archie comic book.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, going back to its early days, and I have many early copies of Rolling Stone just because I have in my Elton John collection, I've got when Elton was on, the cover, and they covered him in the, within the magazine in the mid and early 70s. Rolling Stone started out as a thick newspaper, a folded newspaper. It was printed on newspaper. And it was almost like a thick Sun Times. And
right.
Then into the 80s, they went away from that. And then they went to a magazine format. It was still oversized. And it was still printed on the same kind of, newspaper print. It was just a lot more color was used, and it was a little oversized. And then in the 90s, it got much more glossy. It got a the perfect binding, which didn't have the staples anymore. It was a perfect bound with just that flat kind of edge, almost like a book, and got much glossier. And the the layout got bigger. And the other side of the coin, though, aside from the visuals of it, the editorial, as I said before, the editorial side of the magazine began to get a little muddied because they didn't, all of a sudden, especially in the early 90s, we had the rise of the boy band and of Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera, and like pop began to take over.
Right.
And so, here was Rolling Stone. It was always like, the monolith of rock and roll, like you said, the interview. And to be on the cover of Rolling Stone
was a huge deal.
In its heyday. I mean, if you remember, there was a group called Dr. Hook, which even had a song called The Cover of the Rolling Stone. I mean,
right.
That was a big deal. If you were in the music business, your goal was to get on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. And but then it seemed that the magazine itself was kind of not respecting its own image, and people that I felt were kind of unworthy to be on the cover because it had become such a, just such a staple of pop culture and rock music. I was like, well, wait a minute. Should that person be on the cover of Rolling Stone? Are we going to hear about this person in 4 weeks?
Right.
You would want a substantial personality and someone that, like you said, Bruce Springsteen or The Who or somebody that's been around for a while and is going to be around forever. And Rolling Stone sort of went more with the fads and went with the times. And yes, I understand you want to sell magazines and you got to try to change. But in Rolling Stone's case, if you change too much, then you lose your total identity. And I think that's what kind of happened.
Well, the other thing I remember, you talk about the cover and who was on it. I remember what a huge deal it was. I think it was in 84 when Duran Duran was on the cover, and it said the Fab Five.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Remember that?
Yes,
and that was kind of that start, what you're talking about something that's so popular. I mean, they couldn't ignore Duran Duran, but the outrage after that issue came out, first of all, calling them the Fab Five instead of obviously the Fab Four for the Beatles, but also, what are you putting these, boy band, pretty boys on the cover of this? These guys have nothing to say. There was a lot of backlash, and that was the start of that turn to, like you said, the more popular stuff that was popish and not so much, the soul of the magazine. What it started out with, like I said, with an interview with John Lennon or Robert Plant or Jimmy Page or whomever.
Yeah, and I mean, and don't forget, I mean, you have to remember that when you look back at the history of Rolling Stone, David Cassidy was on the cover of Rolling Stone, so you know, right. we can't get on our high horse. But this, but and so he was as much of a pop idol and teen idol as there ever was. But the whole idea of that story was that he was trying to change his image.
Yeah, he was trying to transcend and go to be, quote, the more serious artist, as opposed to, like you said, the softening of the magazine, the softening of, hey, I'm on the cover because I'm a pop sensation.
Exactly. And so, as I said, I think what happened, you could even see, I mean, to be reviewed in Rolling Stone, if you were an album, you know, if you were an artist, I mean, that, once again, that was a big deal because everybody, you know, who liked rock music picked up Rolling Stone and read the reviews. And the reviews became, you know, something that you went to read in that magazine the first thing. And some of the most popular, you know, rock critics came out of Rolling Stone. But what happened then is as time went on, you know, all of a sudden the reviews got shorter. They weren't as expansive in terms of really digging down deep into an album. They were very kind of superficial. They were smaller to the point where a couple of months ago there was one page of reviews, maybe three albums.
I remember when they used to take five or six pages of the big print or, right. or the big magazine, you know, back in the day. And it really went into depth of every song of a record and explained what was going on, as opposed to this glossed over version that you talk about now.
Yeah, and that's where, like I said, the decline of the magazine editorially, I believe, did not happen overnight, but it did happen gradually, I would say, over the last 10 or 15 years. And as I said, it really started to hit because, you know, in terms of a rock and roll movement in terms of a song, of kind of a sound. The last big rock and roll push was grunge in the early,
right, the early 90s,
early
yeah.
to mid 90s. And then, you know, Kurt Cobain died and a lot of those other bands sort of came and went. And while you still have people like Pearl Jam and now there's a reunited Smashing Pumpkins around, and even though, Stone Temple Pilots, Scott Weiland died. I guess they have a new, singer. So some of the grunge bands from the early 90s are still around, the ones that really had, you know, sold a lot of albums. But then after that, as I said, the boy bands and the pop divas and your Mariah Careys, and then gave birth to your Britney Spears, and then your Britney Spears gave birth to Katy Perry, and Katy Perry gave birth to Kelly Clarkson, and then the rise of hip hop. And suddenly Rolling Stone, as I said, was always defined because rock and roll was the music of the counterculture. So I guess Jan Wenner could argue, well, Rolling Stone was always about, you know, the counterculture, and rock music may have been its initial soundtrack, and so we're just following the trends of the culture. But, you know, let's be honest, when you think about Rolling Stone, you think about rock music. You don't think about pop music or hip hop music. Or even for a while, they even put a country issue out.
Oh, they did that, and I even remember when I was still working at US 99 when Shania Twain was on the cover. And again, they followed. Hey, she's the biggest thing in not just country music, but in music in general. Let's throw her on the cover. And of course, Madonna years before that, same deal. Like I said, Britney Spears and all these different acts. They just said, whoever everybody's talking about, that's who we're going to throw on the cover.
Yeah, and then once again, in its history and in its heyday in the 60s throughout the 70s, they also had, you know, stories about movie stars too, and they continue to do that. But there was a lot more. It seemed like then, as time in the last 10 or 15 years, there was a lot more movie stars on the cover as opposed to
right.
music stars. So they were always kind of grappling with that, and so I was not surprised that, because now Jan Wenner has got to be close into his 70s. I understand his health is not even that good anymore. He's had a heart attack and apparently he's broke a hip or something.
Mm-hmm.
So in October, they announced that they were going to sell Rolling Stone, and it was a surprise in one way because, oh my gosh, I mean, you know, for a certain generation, Rolling Stone has always been there, and it was this, this pillar of journalism. And don't forget some of the writers like Hunter S. Thompson.
And PJ O'Rourke, a lot of people,
PJ O'Rourke and Tom Wolfe, who just passed away. So it was kind of like Playboy in that it had a very specific kind of audience, and it was talking about the culture. It was also a literary magazine. It also was an investigative magazine. It also talked about politics and the environment and that whole thing. Of course, a couple of years ago, you may remember, they got in a lot of trouble because they did a story about a rape case that never that the story was not substantiated.
Oh, yeah, at a college campus, right?
Yeah, and that really hurt their credibility. And so I want to take a quick break here, and then we'll continue with Mick, because then all of a sudden, when they announced that Rolling Stone was going to be sold, that wasn't a surprise, but I got a surprise in the mail just this week.
Okay.
And so we will talk about that on the other side of this break. But before that, let me just say that this week, Chicago's Best is pigging out. From bacon to porchetta, it's Chicago's best pork this Sunday night. At 10 on WGN TV, Chicago's best pork. I'm just going to leave it there and just go. We'll be back right after this. Jim Toronto filling in for Nick DiGilio. No switching. Jim Toronto with you here at WGN, 720 AM in Chicago. We're in the Pop Culture Club with Mick Kaler. We're talking about Rolling Stone magazine, which, as I said earlier, was announced in October of last year that it was being sold. And it sent a shockwave for a certain generation. I'm sure that people, for instance, producer tonight, Dan Long. Dan, do you ever read Rolling Stone? Do you even care about Rolling Stone?
I read it when I was a little bit younger. I've not been keeping up with it at all, though.
Yeah, exactly. I'll tell you the truth of this, too, is the only reason that I even get Rolling Stone today, and I've told this story a few times, I still get Rolling Stone. I have been a subscriber since the late 70s. And about 20 years ago now, it's been that long, I got an offer from Rolling Stone for $30 to become a lifetime member. Now, I mean, if you've ever bought a subscription to a magazine, $30 is nothing.
One-time payment, $30?
One time.
Okay.
Yeah, one time. And you know,
they needed a cash grab, so that's what you did.
Yeah, and don't forget, Rolling Stone came out bi-weekly.
Right.
So it was every 2 weeks there was a new issue. So for $30, that was an amazing deal. So I said sure, and so I've been getting it. I sent the $30 in. So I tell you, if not for getting that deal, I don't think over the last 15 or 20 years I would have renewed my subscription at all. I really don't, because they said the magazine really, as Mick said earlier, not only did it, you know, editorially kind of lose its way, but it wound up being like a regular size magazine and like 62 pages. I mean, you could literally page through that thing in 10 minutes.
Right, between the ads and the shorter articles.
Yeah.
And like you said, less pages, it was nothing. I was stunned when I saw that. I was like, is this some special little featurette? I'm like, no, that's the actual magazine. It's shrunk down to a comic book.
Yeah, so then I was shocked just this week. I was on vacation over Christmas, and so I missed this news that they actually were bought. So in October, it was announced that they were selling the magazine. And I guess they announced right around Christmas, when nobody could even, you know, no one's even paying attention to the news, and news gets buried around Christmas, especially 5 days before Christmas, that they had been purchased. So I had no idea. In fact, I was wondering to myself, geez, I wonder if they're just going to close it down. Obviously, nobody wants it. It's got a strong brand name, but just like Playboy, it just seems irrelevant at this
point.
Right. And so all of a sudden, I go to my mailbox a couple of days ago, and there's this giant magazine, this oversized magazine, very hefty, with a perfect binding. And I'm like, what is this? And I turn it around, and much to my surprise, it's Rolling Stone magazine.
Wow. Who was on the cover?
Well, here we go. Cardi B.
Oh, God.
And her husband, Offset. And Cardi B is pregnant. Her stomach and her whole bottom torso is naked. There's this giant, she's got a giant tattoo all over her her stomach and her thigh, so you see the side of her butt, and he's kissing her pregnant stomach. And I guess this is supposedly, I mean, ever since Demi Moore did that, how many years ago on Vanity Fair?
On Vanity Fair, the cover, yeah.
Been taking this picture of the pregnant body, but so they have the same logo, but it's not outlined. It's much more kind of, sedate. But it has 130, let me see how many, I mean, I couldn't believe this, 136 pages.
Well, they doubled it from what they were shrunk down to.
Yeah, so it's bigger in size. It's kind of an interesting finish. There's on the cover. There's a whole new layout. Many more stories. Many less. Once again, like three music reviews. I mean, it's just amazing how that has just taken a back seat. And so I read. I'm looking through this, and then there is a letter from Jan Wenner explaining everything about our new direction, and he's still sticking around as the editor, you know, but who knows?
He still has a hand in it somewhat.
Yeah, we'll see, and so do his two of his kids. But I'm just wondering if this new magazine is just the way for the new owners to kind, because apparently this publishing company has a very big profile online, and so I'm wondering if, you know, to throw a bone to the old print version, they went out and splurged on this one, their first print, issue, and made it into this whole kind of cool, glossy, big, thick thing. So I'm interested to see what the next one's going to look like. And I'm wondering.
So you said Cardi B and Offset were on the cover.
Right.
So there's obviously a very flattering feature interview with them, correct?
Oh, sure, definitely. In fact, Cardi B was just on like maybe a month ago. So she's already been on twice in the last month.
Okay, put that in perspective. I was just watching the other day, the movie Almost Famous was on cable, and I was watching it, and they bring up in the movie, because they talk about Rolling Stone magazine, because that's who the kid in the movie was reporting for,
right,
to meet the band Stillwater, and they talk about how Rolling Stone trashed the first couple of Led Zeppelin albums.
Right.
So you've gone from a magazine that trashed the first couple of Led Zeppelin albums to Cardi B and Offset, what's his name?
Offset.
Offspent?
Set. Offset.
Oh, Offset. You got them on the cover. That's the change you've made from the early 70s
no
to
kidding.
2018.
Yeah. Well, on the other side of the news, we will continue to talk about Rolling Stone, because there is actually a story in this current issue that might be worth discussing. So we will continue with the pop culture segment after the news. Elton Jim Toronto with you here at WGN, 7:20 a.m. in Chicago. Filling in for Nick DiGilio, be here till 5 a.m. And we are right in the middle of a discussion of the Pop Culture Club with Mick Kaler, and we have been talking about the new, the past, the present, and what may be the future of Rolling Stone magazine. One time a major, major magazine. And don't forget, Rolling Stone Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone became a media and publishing empire. It used to own, I think, Men's Journal as well as Us Weekly.
And they had an outdoor magazine, too.
Yeah, so, I mean, as I said before, at one time, Rolling Stone magazine, when it first started, was this little, this kind of small, little, almost independent, ramshackle little magazine, the little engine that could. That suddenly, found a voice and found an audience. I mean, talk about timing, and that's what life really is, especially in business. There was a need for a magazine like Rolling Stone in the late to mid-60s as the baby boomer generation began to get older and began to exert its power of thought, but also its consumer power of buying things. And advertisers obviously wanted to reach that group. And so Rolling Stone certainly took advantage of that. And as I said, it really was reflective of the mood and of the thoughts. And rock and roll certainly played a role in that, as well as, film and everything of that era, where you were starting to get a more, liberal-minded, progressive kind of, counterculture that was emerging, especially during the times of the Vietnam War when the protests were going on. So, as I said, Rolling Stone certainly provided a forum and provided a voice for, you know, a growing, you know, generation. But as time goes on, you know, the counter, meet the old boss, same as the, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. You know, and Rolling Stone kind of became the establishment, and it's hard to be a rebel when you're in charge.
Well, the one thing I was going to bring up, too, when we were talking about the 80s, when we were starting to see this turn to the popular stars that were on the covers of the magazine, one other thing that kind of really put a tinge to Rolling Stone, 1985 was the beginning of Spin magazine. Remember Spin?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
And Spin magazine all of a sudden started doing the, quote, cutting-edge artists, and a lot of the acts that they were on the cover were ones that maybe you never heard of again after that, but they were the ones jumping into, as far as, especially with music, with these artists that maybe normally wouldn't get major play or attention, and Spin magazine all of a sudden had more credibility in music than Rolling Stone did.
Well, and certainly to your point, so what happened was, and that's a really good, it's a really good analogy, is that all of a sudden Spin was looking around at the market and saying Rolling Stone is not servicing the rock music of the day anymore. You know,
that's exactly what happened, yeah.
And so they were like, wait a minute, Rolling Stone has become this big, bloated kind of, you know, general, you know, pop culture magazine, and it's lost its way in terms of being the authority and the voice for the emerging alternative rock at that time in the 90s, and whatever music would be coming next. And so they certainly did find a niche very quickly. Even, you remember the magazine Details?
Oh, sure.
Details was another one. It was more of a pop culture-ish and even a little more of a fashion thing, but they also played into the music side, and Details was a trend-setting magazine, as was Spin, and in those mid-90s there, and they really did, you know, have their sights at Rolling Stone, because, as I said, Rolling Stone suddenly became this kind of bloated, lumbering magazine that really didn't know what it wanted to be. Was it a music magazine? Was it a pop culture magazine? Was it a pop magazine? You know, was it a celebrity magazine? You know, like I said, I think it's lost its way for a good 20 years since then, and it really, in the last 10 or 15, really just really lost its identity. So I'm going to be interested to see now, as I said, I want to see what the next issue is, this new issue, the first one of the new ownership. And I had to laugh because the name of the new owners is the Penske Media Group.
The Penskes. The Penskes. Are you Penske material?
Yeah, Mr. Wenner, you are not Penske material.
I have the Penske file right here.
Yeah, I have the Penske file. You didn't do anything in this. Well, I mean, it was a big file. I did change it into the accordion size folder.
Sure.
But according, you know, right at the beginning, there is a letter from Jan Wenner that says the new era for Rolling Stone. It says, "Welcome to the new Rolling Stone. As you can see, we've significantly evolved the magazine into a larger format that will publish monthly rather than biweekly."
So, okay, so you're going to get 12 issues.
Yeah, so now it's going to be less than that. "What isn't changing is our commitment to the integrity, honesty, and quality of our journalism and to our tradition of bold, clean design and original photography. It is our intention to continue that tradition as long as we exist." Now, that's a key thing, as long as we exist. That's an interesting line. As I said, I wonder in the long term, you know, if this company didn't buy Rolling Stone for the brand, you know, they could sell T-shirts with the logo on it. They can have an online presence. But in today's publishing world, it costs so much money in printing costs. I mean, this one issue with 136 pages and the oversized size and the perfect binding and the photography and all the color, this magazine, this issue cost a heck of a lot of money to create. And I don't care if there's only 12 issues from now on. I don't know in today's publishing world if you can afford to do that. So I wonder what the next issue is going to be like. And I wonder if Rolling Stone as an entity, as a brand, as a magazine online, it may exist. But I wonder if the print if the print magazine is eventually going to go by the wayside?
Well, I think you'll know if the next cover of Rolling Stone, you have the Kardashians on the cover.
Yeah, well, and you know, and the funny thing is, as I've said a few times as well, so when I get this this Lifetime subscription that I was offered about 20 years ago for like $30, how do you turn that down? The one thing that now I wonder, you know, I have to change my thinking. As everybody knows, when you get a subscription to a magazine, if you look at all, you know, there's all those numbers and all those letters, you know, above your name. And usually you can tell that when your subscription is up.
Right. You'll see a date, you know, a number for the date,
yeah,
the year,
it says
and all
like
that.
The month and then, like, you know, two numbers for the year. So, as I told you, I got a Lifetime subscription. So one day, soon after I got this new subscription for a Lifetime, I happened to just be looking at the mailing label, and I saw that it said August, and it said 59. And I said, well, wait a minute. Rolling Stone doesn't think, in their minds, by 2059, they're stopping my subscription. Now, don't forget, I have a Lifetime subscription.
Right.
So
maybe they're looking at your life expectancy.
Yeah, so they're saying, well, Jim, in 2059, your Lifetime subscription, we will not be filling because you won't be around to receive it. So for many years, I mean, that was, first of all, it was a little shocking when you actually see the date.
Yeah, when it's going to end for you, right?
Your demise, which, we know, I mean, we don't know this, but I was so then my joke was, I am determined to outlive Rolling Stone's prediction.
In fact, so that way you can demand more of your magazine.
Right. So in 2060, I'm calling up Rolling Stone, or even in September or October of 2059, when I'm 89 years old, and I'm going to call them up and say, hey, where's my issue? But now it looks like I'm going to outlive Rolling Stone.
It could happen, yeah.
I was worried about, you know, Rolling Stone outliving me. But given the current state of the magazine, as well as the publishing world, I think I'm going to outlive Rolling Stone.
I think you're covered there, pal.
Yeah.
So, you know, one thing I wanted to bring up, too, when you were quoting the Jan Wenner statement that he made, he mentioned photography.
Right.
How can we forget the photography of an Annie Leibovitz?
Oh, definitely. I mean, Annie Leibovitz, who's gone on to be one of the most popular magazine as well. It's just any kind of photographers, but certainly the pop culture and entertainment, photographers, and her work now appears regularly in Vanity Fair and other magazines. She was just some like 20-year-old college student.
A groupie with a camera.
Yeah, who sort of walked into, once again, I mean, the beginnings of Rolling Stone, it was just a ramshackle kind of a magazine, a few little offices, and it was just like a party more than a frat than it was a business. And she sort of walked in, and Jan said, yeah, we'll go to this concert here. And suddenly, he basically, started her career. And, when you talk about the great magazine, I mean, that's the thing about Rolling Stone. I don't want to... just push it aside, because in its day, it was really an important magazine. And to your point, from the photography, from the journalistic side, as I said, there were writers like Hunter S. Thompson and Tom Wolfe. And as I said, you had the Rolling Stone interview. Those Rolling Stone interviews used to be like 7 or 8 pages, and they would spend 2 or 3 weeks with the person, living with them, and you'd get this background information and this behind-the-scenes information that you couldn't get anywhere else.
Yeah, it was a major deal where you get these little inside stories because, like you said, the journalist and the photographer would just basically live with these guys, whether or women, on tour or in their personal lives, etc.
And there were some great photos of Bob Dylan and John Lennon. And, I mean, and of course, I think what has been voted maybe the best cover not only of Rolling Stone, but perhaps of any magazine, I believe, is the chilling and sad picture of on the day that John Lennon was killed, Annie Leibovitz.
Yeah, the picture of John and Yoko.
Yeah, Annie Leibovitz went to the Dakota where they lived, and they took this photo of John, who was naked, and Yoko was fully dressed, and they were both laying down, and he was kind of in the fetal position hugging her. And that was printed then after, after, because it was shot on the day that he was killed. And obviously, a couple of weeks later, the next issue, that was the cover. And I believe that that photo may have been voted, if not the best cover of Rolling Stone, one of the best covers of any magazine of all time.
And the other part about those cover shots, and they had unusual ones. I remember there was one of Whoopi Goldberg in a giant bathtub full of milk.
And exactly.
There were all sorts of different, you know, creative expressions. It wasn't just a quick picture. There is a whole book, I have it, of famous Rolling Stone covers.
Oh, definitely. So, like I said, Rolling Stone, I don't want to make it sound as if, oh, it's just this magazine that's been irrelevant for a while. There is no question. And I ultimately, what I have to say about Rolling Stone at the end of the day is you cannot deny the impact and the influence of Rolling Stone magazine.
It has major heritage,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, it played its role, but, you know, But when I say it lost its relevance, what I mean by that is, and it's not really, you know, it's not even a cut against it or something bad about it. It's not a criticism. It's just that it was an idea for its time, and it certainly, as I said earlier, you know, it filled a need. But maybe 50 years on, you know, that just isn't relevant anymore. That idea isn't needed. That void isn't there anymore. And so maybe it's okay to just say, you know what? It's time to go away. The world doesn't always have to have a Rolling Stone magazine. It had a Rolling Stone magazine when it needed and wanted a Rolling Stone magazine. But maybe now, 50 years later, there's just no need for it and people don't want it.
And again, it's quite possible that you're right about that. I was just thinking as you were talking about that, I was thinking the other day because I had a friend who used to work at a photomat. Remember photomat?
Exactly. Yeah, they had a little hut like in a parking lot
where you would drop off your film to be developed.
Right.
Okay. How many photomats are left now?
Well, how much film is left? Forget about photomat.
That's exactly it. And even though there is still music and it's still a vibrant thing into a lot of people's lives, it's so spread out, and again, the reporting of it can be done by anybody who's got an internet access and post up whatever they want. All of a sudden, the influence and the importance of a Rolling Stone magazine goes by the wayside.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that. There are certain cars that at one time were very popular. They don't make that model anymore. This happens. It's just the natural course of evolution. And so I understand if you're a Jan Wenner, this has been your life and you want to see it go on, but maybe it's time is past. And instead of keeping it on life support, maybe it's just thank you and good night.
Yeah, it could very well be that. Well, it'll be interesting to see, like I said, what your next few magazine covers are going to look like every month when you get your new issue.
I'm certainly interested in seeing that. We're going to continue to talk because just as we say about how irrelevant Rolling Stone magazine is, there's a story in here that's actually worth talking about.
I know. As soon as I saw that online, I was like, hey, we got to talk about this, even though we're not sure how much impact it has on our lives.
So we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Mick Kaler and the Pop Culture Club. I'm Jim Toronto filling in for Nick DiGilio. It's about 2:50 a.m. We'll be back after this. No switching. Jim Toronto with you at WGN, 7:20 a.m. in Chicago, filling in for Nick DiGilio. Be here till 5 a.m. Then we will pass it on to the opening bell, and then Justin Kaufman fills in for Steve Cochran today, and I believe probably tomorrow as well, too, right, on Friday. So that's the game plan. But right now we are talking to Mick Kaler about Rolling Stone magazine, and I just got a text which makes a really good point here, Mick. I thought I would bring this up.
Mm-hmm.
He mentions, I don't know if it's he or she, I shouldn't say that, but thanks for the text, 815. 815 texts and says, Mad Magazine was another magazine that was a binding figure of the past era, and that is true, too. And look at that, Mad Magazine, for that era in the mid-60s and early 70s, I mean, Mad Magazine was one of those magazines. It was iconic.
That was the first magazine outside of, like, Archie Comics that I read when I was, like, 9 years old.
Yeah, I mean, it was Mad Magazine was this magazine of that was just this hilarious, you know, it was a kind of off, off the middle road of jokes and comedy.
Great parodies.
Parodies of movies, parodies of things. Alfred E. Newman, What Me Worry, became the face. It was an iconic figure. Kids of, like, to your point, young kids as well as teenagers and people in their 20s and 30s would all pick up Mad Magazine.
Yeah, I went from Archie Comics to Mad Magazine, and then besides Rolling Stone, there was National Lampoon.
Right, exactly, the same thing. Remember Cracked?
Oh, sure, Cracked was like a magazine like Mad. It was kind of like an imitator of it and did the same thing that Mad did.
Yeah, it was an offshoot of that. But now, once again, you know, do you hear people talking about Mad Magazine? I mean, I, at home at my house, I have a little statue of Alfred E. Newman.
There you go.
On display, where his hand's out and it says, what, Me Worry? I mean, you know, it's a classic, pop culture, figure. But as I said, just like Rolling Stone, in today's world, did Mad Magazine doesn't have the impact or the relevance that it once did. And that's okay. You know, as I said, I mean, it had its moment. I mean, just think about what the odds of a magazine like Rolling Stone or Mad Magazine ever becoming, or like you said, National Lampoon, ever becoming a huge success. And yet it was. So that is enough. Sometimes.
And to put it in modern day perspective with, again, like, say, a Mad Magazine with their, that they might lampoon or make fun of a current movie or a current president or whatever. Nowadays, with Photoshop and all the things you can do online, you know, what they took a week or a month to do for their magazine, you can do that in about 15 seconds and post it up on Facebook, and everybody sees it.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, ultimately, what happened, the internet. The great irony of the internet, and this goes back into the mid '90s when it first began, taking hold. The irony is that the internet and its ability to is the urgency and the immediacy.
Yeah.
So the funny thing is that the people that were promoting the internet initially to the public was the newspaper and magazine people, saying, because they were news junkies, they were information junkies, and so they were all hyped up because this new tool provided fast access to information. So newspapers and magazines started writing about the internet and, like, hey, this internet is cool and look what you could do, and unknowingly they set up their own demise.
Right.
Because they promoted the internet so much in stories, in the newspapers and in magazines, that everybody said, well, let me take a look at this. And then all of a sudden, the internet started to provide that immediacy that, I mean, don't forget, a newspaper, as soon as the ink hits the paper, the newspaper is irrelevant. Because something can happen in the next 5 minutes that the internet can tell you about, and the newspaper is now, it seems like it's 40 years in the past. As soon as that ink hits the paper, it's done.
And now we live in this 24-hour news cycle, where it's even, I consider it a 12-hour news cycle nowadays, with the immediacy of cable and internet and all that, that things have changed.
And the same thing, like you said, so like a magazine like Rolling Stone, every day, if you go on Yahoo, you go on any kind of search engine, there's all these stories about celebrities and what's happening this minute, and who tweeted this and who did that, and pictures of this and pictures of that. So how can a magazine like Rolling Stone, that's trying to be cutting edge, it can't break news anymore?
No, and it can't. Like I said, the immediacy is lost. And everybody's on top of it. It's funny, because even a few years ago when I stopped buying People magazine, I stopped because every time I'd get an issue, I'd get it at the Jewel, I get my groceries and all that, I pick up the new People magazine, and I'd thumb through it. I'd be like, I read that story,
exactly.
Already saw that online, saw that on the news, done that, and it's like, there's nothing here that's new that I need to know.
Yeah, so after the news, Mick's going to stick around. Can you stick around, Mick?
Where else am I going at this time of the night, bud?
Me too. We are going to talk about a story in the new current issue of Rolling Stone, the 100 greatest songs of the century, .. so far. So I thought it was interesting, because we can not only talk about what we think about some of these songs in this list, but we can also talk about how we don't know most of these songs.
We are totally on hip, and I'm happy with it, bud.
Daddy thinks I'm fine. Trying to make me go to rehab. I won't go.
Jim Toronto with you here at WGN, 720 AM in Chicago. Filling in for Nick DiGilio. We'll be here another couple hours or so till 5 o'clock. We'll hand it off to the opening bell. And then at 6 o'clock, Justin Kaufman fills in for Steve Cochran this morning on July 5th. Thank you for listening. Hope you will continue the ride with us until 5. And if this is your regular spot to listen to the radio, then and you like what you're hearing tonight, and you like what you heard yesterday, then climb on board for one more, because I'll be filling in for Nick DiGilio tomorrow morning from 1 to 5 a.m. So I hope you will continue to stay with me right now until 5, and I hope you'll be around tomorrow from 1 to 5. I think you're going to like it, especially in the wake of all this hot weather that we're having. Let me just say that I think tomorrow's show may be refreshing, and I'll leave it at that. That'll be the tease for you to come back tomorrow at 1 a.m. here at WGN. But right now, I'm talking to Mick Kaler in the Pop Culture Club, and we're talking about Rolling Stone magazine as it begins its new era. It was recently sold, and a new company bought it back in December, and it just printed its new or first edition, first issue, under its new ownership. And as I said, we will see the magazine world and printing and publishing in general has been just decimated by the internet over the last 20 years. Look at newspapers, as well as some of your favorite magazines have gone by the wayside, or certainly have become mere shadows of what they used to be. But at the same time, as Mick and I were just talking about the demise of Rolling Stone over the last 20 years, and especially who knows what its future may be, despite having a new owner, when I look in the latest issue, I see a story that is interesting and worth talking about.
Thank God for that.
Yeah. So this is an interesting topic, and they've done this at least online. They do have a strong online presence, as I said, the new owner of Rolling Stone. So we'll see if they continue to push more things online. I saw a story that they did recently about the top 50 albums, the best 50 albums of 2018 so far. So they seem to be on this kind of kick about the so far stuff.
Right.
Because this story is a fairly big story in the magazine, the print issue. The 100 greatest songs of the century, ... so far.
And we're 18 years in.
18 years in, which I mentioned this yesterday. I mean, we're almost one-fifth done with this century.
It's gone fast.
I mean, I remember the year 2000, New Year's Eve, when we went from 99 to 2000. Even though I know officially the new century didn't start until 2001, or 2001, as I say. I'm tired of hearing the 2000s. You know, by the way, you'll notice, I always say 2018. We're done with the 2018. You don't say that anymore. When it was in the 1970s, did you say 1972?
No, you just said 1975,
yeah,
1990.
So why do we keep saying 2018, or which it's 2018, 1972, 2018? We never said, oh, it's now 1984. No, it was 1984. So enough of that 2000 stuff. We're over that. I could see at the beginning when there was a lot of zeros, it didn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's 2018, it's 2019, it's 2020, it's 2017. That's it. Ugh, enough of that. So I played Rehab, which is on the list, and Rolling Stone's top 100 songs of the century.
Amy Winehouse, sure.
So far. So that one, Amy Winehouse's Rehab, came in at number 20. And as I'm looking at this list, there's two things struck me. I guess it was just my own kind of culture shock when you see just how many, how dominant at this point hip hop is. It is the music of the time. There's no question.
Oh, absolutely.
About that.
The way rock was in the 60s and 70s, it's definitely hip hop now.
Yeah, I mean, rock and roll is I love rock and roll, and that's my music. Don't get me wrong. But sadly, I have to say that in its current state and where it continues to go, I would say another 5, 10, maybe on the outside 15 years, and if you're lucky, 20 years, but I don't think it's going to be 20 years. I think it's going to be much sooner than that. I think rock and roll ultimately is going to be relegated to a niche kind of music like jazz or big band music, which was once the dominant music of the day for many decades, and then it went away. And,
I think rock's going to fade out like that, too. And I don't hope for that, but it's just the way we see things happening.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to go away because I think, you know, I mean, we have to also realize, too, I don't think this is just an opinion. I think there's facts to back this up. I believe when they start to write the history books, and we're almost, 50 years now past, say, the, 60 years since Elvis and 50 years since the Beatles came on the scene, more than that now. So we certainly can start writing those history books, but I think you really have to look at the 50s and certainly the 60s and mid to late 70s. That was a renaissance time for popular music. And, you know, just like in Italy when there was Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo and there was the Renaissance there, you know, that was an incredibly creative time when those people were doing their thing, just like when the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the Who and all these other bands and rock and roll was just dominant. And, you know, after da Vinci and all those people, there were artists right after them, and they were popular, and people went to see their works, and everybody made a big deal about them, but they weren't like the masters.
Yeah, the golden era of rock was definitely that time you're talking about.
Yeah, and so I hate to say it, but I don't see how rock and roll can ever. I mean, I know that there's people that are keeping their fingers crossed, but I just don't think it's going to come back because here's something that I think really at least hit home for me. The other day I saw a commercial. I've never seen this before. I saw a commercial for a guitar at Guitar Centers on television.
Wow.
Because, you know, before, I don't think guitar shops and a place like Guitar Center ever had to advertise because they just had this natural audience of kids growing up wanting to play the guitar.
Right, wanting to have a garage band, wanting to get a bunch of guys together and make music. And that's kind of a foreign thing now.
Yeah, and so because now everything is with beats, everything's done electronically, technology-wise. You know, hip hop. You know, most of the hip hop artists don't play an instrument at all.
Well, my favorite thing is the popularity of DJs who show up in front of tens of thousands of people with pre-recorded stuff.
Yeah, with an iPod.
Yeah, here you go. I'm here. I'm going to push a button. Now jam.
And I'm going to wear a mouse head.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I mean, so when I saw this commercial for a Les Paul guitar, $3,500 at your local Guitar Center, I said, "Wow, they must be hurting when they start," because I've never seen Guitar Center, you know, advertised on television.
No, everyone knew that's where you had to go, and that's what you aspired to do. Now they're looking for this niche audience of people that say, hey, I want to learn how to play the guitar. Again, as you said, in modern music, who knows what a guitar is anymore?
Yeah, so there once again, there's a huge shift in music and a musical taste. And as like I said, as much as I love rock and roll, here's the hard reality of it, folks, and we'd love for these people to live forever. But, you know, Paul McCartney, I think, is 76 or 77 years old.
Yeah, Roger Daltrey's like 74.
Yeah, you know, Elton John, my favorite, is 71. Bruce Springsteen is 68. All these classic rock artists are now in their late 60s, early 70s, if not late 70s, and almost 80. I mean, I went to Los Angeles a couple weeks ago. I saw Rod Stewart and Cyndi Lauper. Cyndi Lauper is 65 years old.
Yeah.
Cyndi Lauper.
Remember when she was just a little girl?
Yeah. Who just wanted to have fun.
Yeah.
And now she's 65. Now it's old ladies just want to have fun.
Geriatric.
Yeah. I mean, you know.
Menopause.
Yeah. You know, and so I was like, my gosh, if Cyndi Lauper is 65 and there's Rod Stewart, 73, you know.
Yeah.
You know, still singing about, do you think I'm sexy? You know, if you want my body.
Grandpa, sit down, please.
Yeah. So here, but the reality of the situation, as much as we don't want to, maybe face it, is within the next 10 or 15 years, you know, the reality is that many of the remaining classic rock stars are going to be either gone or probably not able to. Look at Neil Diamond. He has to, you know, quit performing because of Parkinson's disease. You know, age hits everybody. And, you know, Mick Jagger is in his mid-70s. So, I mean, it'd be great if Paul McCartney lived to be 95. But even if he did, could he still play and sing?
Well, and the other part of that is, you're talking about these classic rock artists, there is nobody following behind, you know, a Paul McCartney, a Bruce Springsteen, an Elton John in the rock genre to say, okay, now we're filling in. I mean, like, you had early rock pioneers like Elvis and Chuck Berry, et cetera, and then the Beatles came, and then, you know, The Who came, and Springsteen, and all that stuff. And there were people coming back to fill up those ranks. Okay, Elvis is dead, but guess what? We have Bruce Springsteen, or we have this artist, or that artist. There is nobody coming back, with the exception of maybe Pearl Jam, but Pearl Jam's a classic rock artist now.
Yeah, I mean, so as I said, I really, it's sad to say it, but when that crop of people passes away, and they're still touring because there's still a demand, but there is going to come a time when either their age is going to prevent them from performing anymore, or, you know, the natural evolution of life is they're just going to pass away. And when they are gone, while their music will still be played, it will not have the impact, I believe, that, you know, that it will have with them still around. And as I said, you know, you still talk about John Coltrane, and you still talk about Miles Davis, but it's you know, it's as I and I use them as examples of jazz, but it's a small niche, and I think there's going to come a time, you know, you talk to people. My godson is in his mid-30s, and I mentioned some people, and he doesn't know who some of these people are.
Yeah,
and in my mind, it's like, oh my gosh, these are the Mount Rushmore of music, and
these are automatics. You know, everyone would know if you're into that music.
Yeah, and he looks at me like, oh, I've heard of them. So,
well, it's funny you mentioned that I've heard of them line, Jim, because when I looked at that list of Rolling Stone of the top 100 songs, you know, so far of the century, I don't know many of those songs. I've heard of some of those artists.
Right.
I've heard the names. I've heard of Outkast, and I think I've seen them on SNL. I couldn't name you one of their songs, but I didn't know many of the song titles at all.
Yeah, I'll tell you. I mean, that was kind of the chilling thing for me, was I went through the top 100, and I said, to your point, yeah, I know who Taylor Swift is. Yeah, I know who Gnarls Barkley is. I know who Adele is. I know who Lorde is. You know, I know who Kanye West is. I know who Britney Spears is, as I'm looking at this list. You know, I know who, you know, Bruno Mars is. I know who Rihanna is. I know who Lady Gaga is, but...
Yeah, you know, their pictures or their personas.
Yeah, but I, you know, I know who Daft Punk is, but I don't know if I could list 17 of their songs.
Or could you even hum one?
No, and I was like, I'm reading this going... Wow. I mean, and I'm somebody who still listens to the radio, still reads these magazines, you know, and still keeps up. And yet I think it's just the natural, once again, the natural evolution of music. And, you know, once again, I will admittedly say I am not into hip hop or rap music. I wasn't into it. And if he said, oh, well, you know, you're too old for it. No. Listen, gang, I was 24 years old or 20. I was 23 or 22. When Run DMC and Beastie Boys and all that were all coming up in the rap genre, and they started to establish rap music. I was in my early 20s. I certainly could have jumped on that bandwagon. I just
didn't. And I was only a couple years older than you, am, but it's like
it wasn't the same thing.
I'm like, okay, I'm around for this to happen. I remember when Run DMC jammed with Aerosmith for Walk This Way.
Right.
And I was like, okay, that's okay. And then I didn't climb on after that because I didn't like it. It wasn't for me. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, it wasn't. It's not an age thing, because I was right in the sweet spot of when that was up and coming and beginning to take hold. And so I certainly, if I liked that music, I would have liked it. It just wasn't my cup of tea. I do like a melody. I do like a good lyric. I do like a song about something and not just yelling at each other and having these feuds or whatever it is. And I'm not putting it down, but that's what the genre is. And so it didn't appeal to me when I was 22, and it's not appealing to me now. And like I said, that's okay. I'm not feeling weird about it, but to say, oh, well, you don't like it just because of your age. No, I was there when it started. And it wasn't my cup of tea then. But so what do you think was number one? You saw the story. So Crazy in Love with Everybody Loves Beyonce.
Beyonce, sure.
We love Beyonce. I mean, Beyonce is now a feminist role model, and but my gosh, she is the artist of this generation.
She can do no wrong, and neither can her husband Jay-Z.
Yeah, so they had the top 100 best songs. I'll just give you a few here. So, "Crazy in Love" by Beyonce featuring Jay-Z was number one. "Paper Planes" by MIA. I never heard it. I don't know what that is.
I've heard of MIA, but I don't know the song.
Outkast was number four. La Face. I've heard of one. I've heard of this one. I heard Jay-Z's 99 Problems. I've heard that. And I've heard Rolling in the Deep. That's number eight by Adele.
By Adele, right.
I've heard
Royals. And by the way, in fairness, Adele's had other great songs, but Rolling in the Deep is probably her best. But she could have had three or four songs on that list.
Yeah, I've heard of Royals by Lorde. But
yeah.
I never heard of Runaway. I know who Kanye West is, obviously. Maps by the Ya Ya Ya's. Seven Nation Army by the White Stripes. I was never a big... Were you a big White Stripes fan?
No, not really.
Yeah, everybody talks about Jack White. I think it was that they were looking for somebody to be the next big thing, and I never got into White Stripes.
The only thing I liked about Jack White was when he did the collaboration with Loretta Lynn.
Yeah.
And it's like, people are like, who's Loretta Lynn?
But so go on there. If you know, I mean, once again, Britney Spears is here and Gnarls Barkley. I mean, obviously, Crazy. Yeah, that was a big song. David Bowie's last song, Black Star, is in there. The Strokes, which is interesting. There's you know, Taylor Swift. You know, there's a Bob Dylan song, which is kind of just obligatory. That doesn't deserve to be there. You know, Eminem, you know, Stan, which I know that one. I have, obviously, Pharrell Williams with Happy. So, I mean, there's obviously, I mean, I know some of these songs. You know, Green Day's American Idiot. But
it's funny you mentioned American Idiot because, again, first of all, Green Day, when I saw that, I got excited. It's like, oh, here's a song I know, and I like that whole album, and I like that group. And I started then looking at the songs that, not just the artists, but the songs I knew, and American Idiot was one of them. And I'm like, why do I like that? Because it reminds me of when I was growing up, the kind of rock I listened to, you know, and they were kind of more Ramones-like, but of course I love the Ramones. When I looked at pop songs that they had Teenage Dream by Katy Perry. I really enjoy that song, but it reminds me of my era, you know, our era when we were growing up. The pop sensibilities of a song like that made sense, and it's one that I know very well.
Yeah, well, we'll see now. The century is one almost one-fifth over, so we'll see how that that list changes if Rolling Stone is around by the end of the century.
and if you outlive the magazine subscription.
Exactly, exactly. I want to thank Mick Kaler for joining me this morning. Thanks for staying up, Mick. And
my pleasure, pal.
We will talk again soon. Take care.
All right, man.
All right. Mick Kaler. Jim Toronto here at WGN, 720 a.m. in Chicago, filling in for Nick DiGilio. Be here till about 5 a.m. Hope you will continue to join us. Having a good time. Hope you are, too. If you want to join in the conversation, the phone lines are always here for you at 312-981-7200. And that's also the number that you can text to, but it's always more fun to talk to you. So once again, if you want to join in on something that I am discussing, or if I just bring up something on your own, always open to your suggestions. 312-981-7200. 7200. After the news, I want to talk about what might be in the future for Chicago. I was just in Los Angeles about a week and a half or so ago, and you know, California at the beginning of the year approved marijuana for recreational use. It had always been for medical use out there, and in fact, it was becoming a kind of a joke. Everybody in California had some kind of a medical problem. I think they were handing out these medical cards to get medical marijuana like it was, you know, just some like a free gift card. And so I think they just realized the hypocrisy of the situation. So they finally have approved it for, you know, for recreational use. And Illinois, we're still taking our time, as we always do here in the Midwest. We always have to you know, we can't just jump right in. So right now we have it here for medical use. And you know, within the next 5 years, this entire country is going to be you know, marijuana is going to be legalized. You know that. It's coming. The states where it is legalized, especially for recreational use, have seen huge upticks in their tax revenues. And that's just money that, you know, that states cannot continue to ignore. And so I would think Illinois will probably be in a couple of years. But I would say as a whole, within the next 5 years, the entire United States will probably be marijuana will be legalized. But there's one offshoot of that that you may not realize. And I sort of got it firsthand, or should I say first nose. And so I'll talk about that on the other side of the news. Jim Toronto here at WGN, 720 AM, filling in for Nick DiGilio. Ooh, that smell. Lynyrd Skynyrd, I play that because, as I said, I went to Los Angeles about a week or so ago, and marijuana now has been approved for recreational use. And so I realized that, or remembered that, because, wow. Can you smell marijuana everywhere in Los Angeles? Yeah. Can't you smell that smell? Yes, you can. So, my wife and I, we stayed in Santa Monica, but we rented a car and we drove around Los Angeles and the surrounding areas. But so, when we first landed, we went to, you know, we got there late afternoon in Santa Monica, and so we went to the famed Santa Monica Pier, which you always see in a lot of commercials, and it's right there. It's got the big Ferris wheel, very similar in look, at least from a distance, to Navy Pier, much smaller than Navy Pier. But it's, you know, it's got a little amusement park, so you see the roller coaster and the big you know, Ferris wheel, as I said. And there's a pier, and there's actually, at the very end of the pier, I mean, people are fishing. It's actually kind of funny. I don't know if, what they're catching, but a lot of people come out there with their fishing poles, and they're out there all day. In fact, we were walking along the pier. We got to the very end of it, and it's because it's a great view. And we looked down, and where all these fishermen were, there's, I don't know how sanitary this is, but there was this big table where, I guess, with like a garbage, like a tub next to it, but there was this cutting board with all this blood on it, and I would assume that these guys are, when they catch a fish, they're either filleting it right there, or they're cutting they're doing something, they're gutting it or something, but, I mean, this table, you could see, I mean, it didn't look very sanitary. I don't know if it's healthy or not, but it was there. So there was a lot of fishermen. It is a pier, after all. But it is obviously a place to congregate, and you walk up and down the pier, and there's a little arcade. It's very kitschy. You know, it's a small little amusement park. It reminds me of the old kiddie land that used to be on in Maywood over on North Avenue and First Avenue. And, you know, so it's kind of kitschy, and there's, you know, they even had one of those Zoltar, you know, from Back to the Future, that little machine that tells your future. They had a Zoltar machine there. And they have a small little arcade. They had skee ball in there, and they got these other games. You know, when you push the coins grab the little thing with the claws and everything. So there's a little kitsch factor to it. And there's places there along each side where you can get some food, and there's you know, arts and crafts for sale and things like that. So it's obviously a congregating kind of place. And so we went there, you know, just around 6:30 or 7:00. So you know, I was ready to get the nighttime crowd, and the sun was beginning to set, but wow, on that pier, holy smokes, and I mean that in every sense of the word, holy smokes, can you smell the marijuana? And I was like, as soon as we walked down the pier, I was like, oh, that's right, marijuana is legal here, isn't it? And it reminded me, because last Christmas, my wife and I went to Amsterdam, And I mean, you want to smell marijuana. I mean, you can walk, you can get a, you don't even have to buy marijuana in Amsterdam. You just get a contact high walking around on the streets. And it is everywhere. And it, especially where there's a lot, you know, when you, you know, it's not everywhere in terms of the smell, but certainly when you get into heavily populated areas or even into like restaurants, you can smell it and you're like, wow, where are they all? I'm looking around going, well, where are they smoking it? And it's so funny too, when you, especially in Amsterdam, you're standing in like, say you're at a corner and you're going to cross the street and someone comes up next to you and you could smell it on them. And you're like, oh, well, this guy smokes marijuana. I mean, it's just so obvious. And yet I'm not seeing them smell it, but you know, smoke it. But it's just, you could, it's just palatable. You can smell it. You could feel it. And it was the same kind of thing in, you know, in Santa Monica on the pier. And then we went to some other places in downtown LA. And once again, it's like, oh, that's right. And I'm wondering now, if you remember, it's been a while. But it's been, what, at least 10 years, if not more, that you can't smoke in public places anymore. Now, you may remember that when you could smoke in a restaurant or in a bar or wherever, if you went out for any kind of period of time, 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 hours, you know, you went out to a restaurant or you went out to a bar or a club or something like that, when they allowed smoking in those places, and when you'd come home, you would smell like cigarette smoke. Your shirt would smell. If it was winter, your coat would smell. I mean, there was a very distinct smell of the smoke. Well, now, since you can't smoke in public places, I don't know if you've even noticed it anymore, but you notice when you come home after you go into a restaurant or a bar or something like that, your clothes don't smell like smoke anymore. But I'm just wondering, after having been in Amsterdam, and as I said, especially when you go into a restaurant, I mean, like I said, especially in a small restaurant where you're in close quarters, you could just smell the marijuana on people's coats. Because once again, so I'm wondering, you know, and then I said to myself, well, now does my coat smell? Is my coat getting a contact high from the smokers around me? Because there just seems to be this perpetual hovering smell of marijuana when you get into heavily populated areas, especially in Amsterdam. As I said, we went to some places like, we went to Hollywood and Vine, you know, where the Walk of Fame is in L.A. And so there's a ton of people there, and they're all putting, you know, their fingers and their hands and their feet into the, you know, the concrete at the Chinese theater. And right, once again, right over there, I'm like, oh, wow, that is strong. And so I'm like, wow. You know, once again, I'm looking around. I don't see anybody smoking it. I don't know. I believe, like, even in Las Vegas, and I've been to Vegas a few times over the last couple of years, and it's the same thing now. All of a sudden, that's been, it's been legalized as, you know, for recreational use in Vegas. And once again, you walk around, especially on the streets, and you can smell it. It's, you know, it's just like, it's just a new, it's nothing bad. But it's just like this new smell that you're never used to smelling out in public. And suddenly it's there. Now, I think in most of the states, I think I talked to somebody about the Las Vegas rule. It's very weird. It's I don't know how you can enforce this. From what I understand, I don't know if this is the way it is in California as well. Maybe that's why I didn't see anybody smoking it, even though I smelled it, certainly. So someone was doing it somewhere. But like in Vegas, you can buy it, obviously, you know, at a public place, but you can't smoke it in a public place. You have to smoke it in your home. Well, once again, unless you live at Caesar's Palace, at least you, unless you live in the volcano at the Mirage, I don't know, because the smell is there. And unless you live at the pier in Santa Monica, it's there. At least unless you live at the Chinese Theater in L.A., you could smell it there. And so, like I said, I got to wonder, you know, when I was in, especially in Amsterdam, because it was so strong and prevalent throughout the city. I'm like, boy, do you come home now with your clothes smelling like marijuana? And so if that does happen here in Chicago and ultimately in Illinois, where the recreational use for marijuana will be legalized, I guarantee you, mark my words, July 5th, I told you about this, gang. So I bet you, and I mean, for all I know, I haven't been to Navy Pier in a long time, but for all you know, if you go to Navy Pier, you smell it there anyway. Maybe this is old news, but I just know is that I guarantee you, if it does get legalized, you're going to walk around, in more populated areas, and you are going to start to smell, and maybe at the first, I mean, I was in L.A. for 3 days, and I started to smell it so much that by the time we went to all these, heavy traffic areas, I smelled it, but it wasn't as like, oh, whereas when I first did, it really hit me like, whoa, that's right, marijuana's legal out here. But after 2 or 3 days, it just became like one of the smells. So all I can say is, as we approach the legalization probably of marijuana recreationally here in Illinois, you're going to a new smell of our city and our state is probably going to be cannabis. So get used to it. And we're probably, and after about 10 or 15 years of our clothes not smelling like cigarette smoke when we went out, well, I guarantee you now your coat in the winter or your T-shirt or your shirt or your blouse, whatever you wear out, to go to a restaurant or a bar, you're going to come home and go, oh, okay, I think I have to wash this right now because it smells like a head shop. So that's one of the sidelines. Yeah, it'll be great to be able to go in. And I've been to Colorado several times over the last couple of years, and that's been legal there for, and it's so strange to walk down the street and just see all these marijuana stores completely out in the open and, advertising, and they all have, the clever names, like, the Pot Stop, and stuff like that. I mean, wow, talk about what a difference 50 years makes. You remember, I mean, marijuana was viewed as, something as heinous as LSD or heroin, and now I guess cooler heads or mellow heads are prevailing. So we'll see what the smell of our state and our city is going to be like if we legalize marijuana. Jim Tirano with you here at WGN 720 AM in Chicago, filling in for Nick DiGilio. I'll be here another hour or so, and then we'll pass it off to the opening bell, and then Justin Kaufman will be in here at 6 o'clock filling in for Steve Cochran. So I got a text here, and I want to thank once again. One thing I love about radio is the urgency, and not the urgency, but the instant feedback. It is an intimate medium, but it's also a very instant, an immediate medium as well, which makes it really fun. As I said, texting has really cut down and hurt radio in a way, in that more people seem to be quicker to text than they used to be to call. Before, that was the only way to get through to the host if you wanted to make a statement or a comment or call in about a topic. You would call in, and that obviously from a radio standpoint is what we enjoy, because we get to engage with you and we get to talk. This is an audio medium, and so that is the most logical and the most interesting from our standpoint, because we can get engaged into a conversation with somebody, and even though they may call up about a certain topic or make a certain comment, once you start talking to somebody, who knows what kind of road you go down, and you find a lot of fun and interesting little nuggets along the way, and there's a conversation that started here and ends up way over there. You never expected that. So that, unfortunately, gets lost a lot now as people start texting. But the good thing is, at least people are communicating through the text. And what is really nice is that it's clear that people listen closely. Here it is, 10 minutes to 4 in the morning. You would think for the most part that maybe I'm just here babbling and I'm background noise. And maybe you're falling asleep and whatever. But I just got a text from someone in the 847 area code. I made a comment how my wife and I went to the Santa Monica Pier, and we went to, there's a little arcade in the pier, and there was one of those fortune-telling Zolar, little booths there. I don't know if you remember it, but now I said it was the movie Back to the Future, and this person correctly said, no, it's not from Back to the Future, it's from Big. Yes, I misspoke. You are correct, sir. You are correct, sir. So thank you for that. I'm glad you're listening closely, and I am certainly appreciative of any kind of correspondence, whether it is on the phone or whether it is through text, if I have if I've said something that misspoken or given out some wrong information, and you have you know, you realize it or you recognize it, please feel free to call me or talk to the producer or something, because I certainly there's no egos here. I want to make sure I say the right thing. So yes, thank you for correcting me, and thanks for listening so closely, especially at this time of the morning. Yes, the Zolar kind of, I guess, what would you say, fortune teller game. You put in a quarter, and there's this very odd, kind of scary figure of this Middle Eastern guy that has the turban on, and he's got the big mustache. It's very stereotyped, and I guess that's part of the draw of Zolar, because it is so old-fashioned. But he's got these really wild eyes, and of course, you know, this thing moves its mouth, and he's sitting in this little box, and he's got these tarot cards in front of him, and his lips do move. You put the quarter in, and all of a sudden you hear this recording, and it says, "Oh, hello, friend, do not worry, Zolar sees your future, and you are going to be happy," and stuff like that. And then, of course, a little card comes out, and it has your future on the card. And we actually kept our Zolar card. as a memento, but it's kind of disconcerting. Zolar is kind of weird looking, and his eyes kind of spin around. They're very white, and it was just a little odd, fun but odd. And we did play a little skee ball and a few games in the arcade. Always kind of fun. As I said, I kind of missed the good old Kittyland. Remember Kittyland on First Avenue and North Avenue, which used to be across the street from the former Maywood Park Racing track, which is now gone too. In my day, we had Kittyland and Maywood Park, and we liked it. We loved it. But yeah, so thank you, Zolar, from the movie Big with Tom Hanks, not from Back to the Future with Michael J. Fox. So now we have that all cleaned up. And if once again, if you hear any wrong information that you can correct, by all means, do not be afraid to give a call at 312-981-7200, or as this person from the 847 area code did, just send in a text. I do read them, and in that case, I've just been told it's not Zolar, it's Zoltan. So now, is it I wish this person, see now, if someone called me with that, then I would be able to say, well, is it Zoltan or Zolar? Because I thought the one that I saw was Zolar. And was it Zoltan in the movie? So now I don't know. I'll have to go. I'm on tomorrow. So I'll go home and I'll check my little, because I kept the card. So I'll see if it says Zoltan or Zolar. I thought this one said Zolar. Maybe Zoltan was in the movie Big. So here we go. But right now, those phones are ringing. So I'm going to take a call here. Let's see who we got. So this is Robert. Hello, Robert. How are you doing?
Hello, sir. How are you?
Very good. How are you doing?
Oh, good. Hey, great show, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
Great show. The only comment I was going to make, as far as the marijuana goes,
yeah.
I was telling your producer, my brother lives in Huntington Beach. He's about a block from the ocean.
Uh-huh.
Very wealthy neighborhood.
Yeah.
And when you walk out of that front door, boom, it hits you.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
Oh, and again, I haven't, you know, when I was in high school and college, I used to get high every day. Literally, wake up in the morning, do a bong. After lunch, do bonnets, you know.
Do bongs, man. Do bongs.
Oh, my God. Wake and bake. I mean, it was ridiculous. And as an adult, I haven't smoked in 25 years.
Wow. Okay?
And then my brother's neighbor said, "You got to try it. They've improved it." And
yeah.
I was like, I said, "What? You just try it." So I did a couple hits. I couldn't feel my feet.
That's what I hear. The strains now, I mean, back in the 60s and 70s, you know, they didn't really perfect it. This was probably stuff that just, you know, was just growing naturally, and they were just, you know, sending it out. But now that that marijuana has become a designer drug, and now you go to different places, like I said, in Amsterdam, they even have menus.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's just like craft beer here.
Yeah, exactly.
It's craft weed,
it's
you know.
Craft weed.
Exactly. But the only problem is that if I couldn't feel my feet.
And I'm talking like this.
I feel sorry for the people who are trying to drive a car.
Oh, I know. Well, that's the thing. I mean, you have to realize, you know, everybody is acting very nonchalant about, they're going to be legalizing marijuana. And I even said, I think within the next 5 years, I think the whole country will be legalized. But we still have to realize that it is an intoxicating drug. And and as you said, now there are many strains. They are the pot itself is much stronger, and we have to take that into account if you are going to be driving or doing just as you do when you have to drink. We can't just nonchalantly think, oh, I could smoke a joint now, no big deal. There are physical effects that take place. Just because we've legalized it, it doesn't mean that it's diminished any of its physical effects. As you say, if anything, the legalization is probably going to strengthen the physical effects, because they're going to be making it stronger so people do get their money's worth, if you will.
And remember, now you can find it in all forms. Gummy bears,
right.
You can drink the crap,
the edibles,
you can vape it.
Yeah, the edibles. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, no, it's a, but isn't that smell? I mean, you know, once again, it's so strange. It's not that it's strange of smelling it, but you're smelling it in these states, in these cities where it is legalized, in places that you're just walking down the street, you never would have smelled it in public like that. And suddenly it just hits you. You go, wow, I never smelled that just here on this intersection before. You know,
you legalize it in Chicago and you'll smell it everywhere.
Oh, I guarantee you, on Michigan Ave, any place, as I said, we were in Amsterdam and even in L.A., wherever there was like a tourist attraction or very heavy populated areas, you would just smell it. And like I said, you stand next to somebody, you could smell it on their clothes.
Well, the only good thing is versus getting into a car with a drunk or getting into a car with a stoner, I'll choose a stoner, because odds are he won't be able to find his keys.
Yeah, right. He'll probably fall asleep before he starts the car.
He won't be able to find his keys. That's the only good thing
about
it.
Well, if somebody is with you that has the same reaction to you, they won't be able to feel their feet, so they won't be able to touch the gas pedal or the brake.
Oh, you can't even get up out of your chair. You just fall on your face. All right, have a great show. A good show. Very good.
Thank you, guys. Robert. Take care. Hang loose, dude. Who is here? We've got Julia on the phone here. How you doing, Julia?
Taking my call. First of all, you do a great job.
Oh, thank you.
And I really enjoy having you on. I wish you could be here more often.
So do I.
I just wanted to say I've been to Santa Monica Pier, and it's so beautiful there. Just hearing you talk about brings such nice memories. First of all, when we were there, they had this guy that's on American Got Talent, and he does this little show where he kind of like meditates and flows like in the air. He like floats.
Oh, yes. I remember seeing him.
Just so cool to see that. And it's just, I think it's even nicer than Navy Pier. Just the way they have all the rides set up and the beach, like, it's just amazing. It's not like we have here at Dirty Lake Michigan. Like, there it's real ocean water.
Yeah, no, it's
gorgeous. I remember it was like 70 degrees, but the water was so warm.
Yeah.
And it's just beautiful. I think everybody should, you know, go and see Santa
Monica. Yeah, especially, go Santa Monica Pier. And thank you. I have to run to the news right now. And especially go there at sunset. It's gorgeous at sunset. I'm Jim Toronto filling in for Nick DiGilio. We will be here until 5 o'clock, so I hope you will join us for that last half hour as we go to the main stretch. Jim Toronto here at WGN, 720 AM in Chicago, filling in for Nick DiGilio. Be here for another hour or so, then we hand it off to the opening bell at 5 a.m., and then at 6 a.m., Justin Kaufman will be filling in for Steve Cochran. I was on yesterday morning from 1 to 5. I've been on this morning, started at 1 o'clock, as I said, I'll be here till 5, and I will be also on tomorrow filling in for Nick DiGilio from 1 to 5 a.m. So if you've liked what you heard the last couple of nights, or morning, whatever you want to call it, By all means, I hope you'll join me tomorrow morning at 1 a.m. till 5. As I said, I think tomorrow's going to be a fun and interesting show as well. Given the heat, the humidity, and the oppressive weather we've had the next couple of days, I'm just going to give you a hint and a little tease here and say I believe that tomorrow's show will be coolingly refreshing. And that's all I'm going to say. To see what I mean about that, you will need to tune in tomorrow at 1 a.m. to find out exactly what I was talking about. Hopefully you will. I don't know if you are a regular insomniac, or you you're a third shifter, or not a shapeshifter, but a third shifter, you just like to listen to the radio early in the morning, whatever it is. So glad you are tuned in to WGN, and we're doing our best here to keep you informed and to keep you entertained. So hopefully I'm doing my job. You do your job by keeping it tuned right here to 720. But before we skip away from the marijuana subject, I was talking about having gone recently to Los Angeles and being in California, where marijuana has now been legalized for recreational use, and how I was smelling marijuana at just walking down the street at quite a few areas, just walking around. You smell the marijuana smell there. It's just part of the environment now, and I've smelled that in quite a few places in cities and states where marijuana has been legalized. I said in Las Vegas you smell it, and certainly in Amsterdam. We were there last winter, and really, they're actually, when you go to Amsterdam, you buy the marijuana at a place called a coffee shop. If you're in Amsterdam, when you walk into a coffee shop, don't expect to get a double latte with a shot of espresso or anything. Coffee shops in Amsterdam are basically marijuana shops. And as I was talking to the caller a little while ago, they even have menus and what kind of high do you want? Do you want a mellow high? Do you want this kind of high? And this strain will give you wow, it's really become an art. As he said, instead of craft beer, there's craft marijuana now. There's craft weed. There's craft pot. But I saw this story in the paper today, in fact, tying to the fact of obviously there would be a lot of fireworks, and anybody who has a pet, a lot of times dogs especially. My wife and I have a cat, good old Grimsby the cat, and she doesn't really react too much to the fireworks. She seems to be okay with them. She wasn't running around because there were a lot in the neighborhood last night on the 4th, but she was fine. But I know a lot of dogs get, very affected and very irritated by the fireworks. In fact, I remember several years ago when we were doing the afternoon show, and there was a product called the Thunder Shirt. And I think it's fairly common now. And this was a shirt that you would buy for a dog. I think you could use it for cats as well. But it was for dogs specifically, I think. And I guess if you put this around their stomach, the sense, the feeling of a tight shirt or cloth around them somehow mitigated the fear they had of the explosions of fireworks. I don't know what the connection was, but apparently you put this snug shirt on the dog's torso and it helped with their anxiety due to fireworks. Well, here's the headline. As fireworks burst in the air, hemp may help Fido chill. So now, not only can you bring your dog, it sounds like, it says, the lead of the story says, as the sound of the July fireworks sends terrified dogs running into closets, under the bed or possibly away from home, many pet owners and veterinarians are buzzing about a new way to help man's best friend. Cannabis chews, oils, and dog treats are selling out at local pet supply stores, and veterinarians say that clients have been eager to learn more about the CBD products derived from hemp, the same cannabis plant as pot, but contains little or no THC, which is the component that provides the high in marijuana. Now, I mean, from a dog standpoint, we all know about the sniffing dogs. So clearly a dog knows good pot when he smells it. So now you can actually get your dog some edibles or some marijuana to help them for their own anxiety and to sort of chill out. Hey, man. Hey, Madison, just chill, man. Here, have a little treat here. So instead of brownies laced with marijuana, now we're going to have dog treats laced with marijuana. As I said, dogs, they do know, you know, there's the smell, you know, the dog, the sniffing dogs for marijuana when you go to an airport or anywhere else where there's security, they obviously can sniff out drugs. So now I guess it might be actually behoove the dog owner. You know, everybody, you see now people bring dogs into, obviously, the pet stores, but any other stores. A lot of times, a lot of stores are pet-friendly. So I guess it may make the most sense to bring your dog, if marijuana is legalized, for instance, in a spot where it's legalized, bring your dog into the marijuana shop and let the dog shop away. They already have the nose for it. So you might be sitting there looking at the menu and saying, well, geez, I wonder which one I should get. And your dog might just, you know, go... You know, take this one over here. You know, just let the dog sniff around and let them decide which marijuana to buy, right? I mean, at this point, I'm really surprised. I'm not a dog owner. I have a cat, as I said. I'm really surprised how many stores allow dogs to just walk in. You know, I mean, I know that, you know, a lot of people love their dogs and they don't want to, you know, they're walking them. They don't want to keep them outside. But, you know, for those of us that don't have a dog, it, you know, I don't know your dog. And I'm walking down the aisle and all of a sudden there's this dog staring at me. I don't know if it's going to snip at me. I'm really surprised how easy dogs have been allowed into a lot of public spaces. I'm not afraid of dogs per se, but I was kind of nipped one time, not bitten seriously, but enough to be a little leery when I see a dog that... might be barking a little more than he should at me. And as I said, everybody, oh, he doesn't bite. Well, yeah, you know, my dad had a great phrase. You know, my dad wasn't a big dog lover, so he never had one. So he'd go by somebody's house, and the dog would run up to him and start barking, and they would say, oh, don't worry, the dog doesn't bite. My dad says, he has teeth, doesn't he? You know, I joke, I say, you know, sometimes I think my dad was a genius. He has teeth, doesn't he? Jim Toronto here at WGN, 720 a.m. in Chicago, filling in for Nick DiGilio. Be here till about 5 a.m. We'll pass it off to the opening bell with Steve Grzinich, and then he'll pass it off to Justin Kaufman, filling in for Steve Cochran. So I'm just looking at the text here, and a little earlier I was talking about... visiting Santa Monica Pier in Santa Monica, and how it's not only a pier like Navy Pier in terms of being a place for people to congregate where there are different attractions. There's a Ferris wheel. There's a small little amusement park. There's an arcade. There's food. There's little arts and crafts. I saw something there that I hadn't seen before. This must be the new thing. You know how when you go to any kind of, you know, a street fair kind of thing and they have the people that draw your caricature? Well, now there were two people on the Santa Monica Pier, which I had never seen this before. Maybe I just never noticed at other places in other states or even maybe around here. I don't know if it's common. But instead of the drawing or the caricature, this person... You sat down and they carved your face in like a piece of clay. And it's a small, and the piece of clay was about the size of the artist's hands. And he, just as they have you sit down and they draw the caricature or the portrait of you right there at their little stand, they had this little piece of like molding clay and they had a little knife and he's looking up and they have some of them on display. I don't know if you take them home and then you bake them or you fire them yourself. It wasn't wet clay. It was kind of molding clay. It was a little hard because he was carving it with a knife. So I don't know, once again, how hard it was. I really couldn't tell. And I don't know if you then, as I say, you bake it on your own. I remember our previous cat passed away about 4 or 5 years ago. Oh, beautiful Temmie. Tem's the cat. I miss Tem so much. And after she passed away, we had her her paw print put into, you know, like a piece of clay. And then after she passes away, you know, they give you the imprint. And then they give you that clay, and then you bake that in the oven for a while, and this way it's hard. And so I don't know if that's what you do here, but I'd never seen this before, and I saw two artists doing this, you know, carving people's faces on a piece of clay. So that's a new one. But as I was reading this, the text here, someone said that they, what does it say? In 1958, my aunt ran a hot dog stand in at Playland, and my cousin ran or had the pony ride, and this was in Texas, and apparently they had a pier there, and they had this cutting board, as I was saying, at the Santa Monica Pier. It's not only a place for people to congregate, but there were fishermen out there. You know, we went there one day during the day, and they were out there at the edge of the pier, just sticking their rod, you know, they casting out, and they just had little places to hold the fishing rod, and they're just letting it sit out there. But I saw this cutting board that had blood on it. In a bucket, so clearly they were either cutting the innards out of the fish, or they were filleting them. I don't know, but it just didn't look sanitary to me. But this person said that at this place in Texas, they had the same kind of thing, and they did rinse the table. This person says that they did rinse the table after they threw the remains in the ocean. It was a macabre scene to see the filleted fish trying to swim, but the fishermen were neat. Oh, man. I'll tell you. I've got friends that are fishermen. I've gone out one time. They invited me to go fishing. As you can obviously tell, I like to talk, if you hadn't noticed that yet. The first time I went fishing, my dad was never a fisherman. I never went fishing, you know, like that in a boat. So we went up to Upper Michigan, and so my friends invite me to go fishing with them. So, you know, we get up in the morning, do the whole thing, and so, you know, you're sitting in this boat, and, you know, it's 5 in the morning. Oh, you know, okay, you cast out, and now you're sitting there waiting for a fish to hit. Well, what do you do? So I'm talking to my friends, and they're looking at me like, would you shut up? You're going to scare the fish. And I'm like, well, are we going to just sit here for 7 hours and not say anything to each other? I guess that's what you do. And so I was talking, you know, kind of, you know, throughout the whole experience. We did not catch a lot of fish. And not surprising, that was the last time that I was invited to go fishing with them. So apparently, I am not a very good fish company, because I guess I like to, you know, have conversations when we're out with people. So unless you're, I guess I might be better for deep sea fishing. When you go out there and you just sort of stick the fishing rod into one of those holders, and then you just wait for it to hit, and then you start pulling on it, and everybody's drinking and talking. I might be better for that. But I guess in the rowboat or in the little motorboat, when you go out to a nice little small quiet lake somewhere in Michigan, you know, you don't want to bring me, because I guess I scare the fish away. You know, the funny thing is, you know, I always say about fishing, like I said, I have a lot of friends that are avid fishermen. They go to Canada, they go everywhere. They're avid fishermen. They're in contests, you know, bass contests and you name it, muskie contests. As I said, I went one or two times in my life. And I remember this time that I went, as I'm talking about, so, you know, this was all new to me. I obviously knew how you fished, but I wasn't this close to it. You know, I'm sitting there and they're baiting my line and they're showing me how to cast out, and there's all the bait there. And I mean, we're doing the fishing thing here, you know? And I always felt like, so I made this observation. I think that was another reason why I was never invited back. So I'm sitting there going, so the whole idea of fishing to me seems, you know, very odd in that, what if you were hungry and you went to your refrigerator and there was a nice piece of cold pizza there? and you picked up the cold pizza out of the refrigerator, and you put it in your mouth, and then suddenly a giant hook came out of the pizza and thrusted you out of your kitchen. That's fishing. I mean, that's fishing, right? I mean, this poor fish is swimming around. He's kind of hungry, and he sees a worm or he sees whatever, and he goes, "Oh, I think I'll take a bite of that." And suddenly, there's this hook, and there's this line, and he's being tugged. He's like, "Wait a minute! All I'm doing is I'm just hungry. I just wanted a snack." And suddenly, I've got a hook in my lip, and I'm being dragged out of my home here, because the water is their home. We're invading their home, right? And I'm like, wow, this is really deceptive. This is really kind of mean. The fish is just hungry. What if you were hungry and you went to get a piece of pizza or a sandwich and a giant hook came and threw you out of your house? And then, now once again, I don't know the ins and outs of this, but I'm just assuming in my own experience, whenever you cut yourself and there is blood, there's usually pain associated with that. Now, I've talked to fishermen, my friends, and they say, oh, well, when you catch the fish, it doesn't hurt them. When the hook goes through their lip, for some reason, it hurts everyone else in the animal kingdom, but it doesn't hurt a fish. And I'm like, yeah, but it's bleeding. Yeah, but they don't feel it. I don't know. When I cut my finger, it hurts, and it's bleeding. I got to think that when a hook goes through a fish's mouth, it's got to hurt. There's blood there. You've broken the skin. You've broken a vessel. There has to be pain. I'm just saying. And then they say, well, we're not going to eat them. We're just going to let it out. We're going to let it back into the water. And I'm almost like, well, that's almost worse. Because now I've got this cut in my mouth, and now it's hurting, and I can't. If I'm a fish, I mean, there's no fish doctor. And what if you're a fish in salt water? So now I've got this open wound, and salt is getting into that wound. I mean, this is just physical stuff thing. I assume that's painful. Now, I understand it's a sport, and that's great, and I don't have anything against it, but I just think it's when you break it down, you think about what's really going on. We just think, oh, yeah, we're going to throw the line out there, and we'll catch a couple fish, but you realize the game you're playing is kind of deceptive. The poor fish is just hungry, and you're taking advantage of his hunger. I wonder how you'd feel if someone took advantage of your hunger, and the next time you took a bite of pizza, all of a sudden a giant hook pierced your lip and threw you out of your house. I don't know. That seems to be fishing to me. But once again, I'm a land lover. Jim Toronto with you here at WGN, 720 AM in Chicago. Filling in for Nick DiGilio. Be here tomorrow morning, Friday morning, from 1 to 5 as well. Was here yesterday. Finishing up the shift right now in another 25 minutes. And as I said, I'll be here tomorrow morning, too, from 1 to 5. So if you've liked what you've heard the last couple of days, I hope you'll tune in tomorrow at 1 till 5. And as I said, it's just a tease. I'm not going to go any more into it than this. Given the hot, oppressive weather that we have been experiencing, and looks like we will continue to experience for another week or so, tomorrow's show will be cool and refreshing. And that's all I will say. Let your imagination run wild, and let your anticipation run wild until 1 a.m. tomorrow morning, where hopefully you will join me and find out exactly what I meant by that. You have, 20 hours or so to figure it out. Or you just come back here at 1 o'clock a.m. tomorrow morning, and you will find out the answer to that most interesting little riddle. So, I wanted to mention this. So, as I said, I went to Los Angeles a couple of weeks ago, and I don't know about you, but I do enjoy watching a lot of those travel shows where they have the different restaurants. I watch the Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives with Guy Fieri and, you know, Food Paradise and the Travel Channel and all these different things. So I like watching those, and when we go to a certain, we write them down, and if we ever happen to be in those cities, we look to see. And maybe we actually, if something looks really good, maybe we will actually plan a short trip around a restaurant. And it's been, I would say, for the most part, we have done this quite a bit in different cities. And I think that we have been very satisfied with what was shown on these shows. And when we went there in person, the food lived up to the hype. And I saw two places, one I never heard about in Los Angeles. One was very famous, and I just never had been there before. Even though I've been to Los Angeles many times, I just never went there. And so I said, we're going to go to both of these places this time. We've got the car now. Don't have to worry about cabs or Ubers. So we've got the car. We can drive wherever we want. We're going to go to these places. So let me just tell you that these two places went above and beyond the expectations, and they both lived up to the hype that both I had heard about in terms of other people or just their legends, as well as seeing them featured on a TV show, and the food really looked good. They're actually not too far away from one another, but they're both in Los Angeles. One is called the Apple Pan, and it's on Pico Boulevard near Westwood, and it's very easy to get to. Pico is a street that literally almost runs from Santa Monica right down to downtown Los Angeles. So it's a good street to take as a alternative. If you're driving there, you don't want to maybe drive the freeways, especially at certain times of the day when the freeways are really jammed. And the traffic in L.A., everybody talks about the traffic in L.A. Yeah, it's bad. But the traffic in Chicago is bad. So, you know, people say that because they may come from places where they don't have as much crazy traffic, but let's face it, here in Chicago, we have, and in our suburbs as well, the whole Chicago metropolitan area, especially here in the summer now, my gosh, everywhere you go, you see orange cones somewhere. But, you know, our traffic is bad. Even when it's moving good, it's still not great. And L.A. is just the same. The only difference, I guess, maybe it might feel worse, is that they wisely have in some freeways 5 or 6 lanes and they're all full. So there's just a lot of cars around there. But yeah, there's a lot of bumper to bumper traffic, just like we have here in Chicago. So, I mean, I drove the freeways there. You have to stay in your lane. You have to really watch your lanes. And thankfully my wife has GPS on her smartphone, because there were a few times where if we didn't have that good old voice saying stay into the lane next, you know, the second lane in from the right, if not we would have been on the other side of town. You have to really stay in your lanes out there on those freeways, because many highways seem to merge into and out of the same highway. We have some of those here, but a lot of times our highways are, at least it's not like in the middle lane becomes a new freeway. That's the way it is in Los Angeles. But I did drive around, so I'm just giving you a nice hint here. If you go to Los Angeles, and this isn't, you know, white cloth dining. This is just good old kind of fun comfort food, hamburger kind of stuff. Just casual stuff. But if you're in Los Angeles the next time, I would highly recommend you go to a little place. It's a cool diner that was established in 1947, and it looks like it. It's your cool vintage diner with the chairs that are connected to the, you know, to the counter where you sit, and they give you your drinks in one of those silver holders with the paper cone that you stick in there. I mean, it's just vintage all the way. But regardless of the atmosphere, it's called the Apple Pan, and it's on Pico Boulevard in Los Angeles. And it's near the cross street is Westwood, so it's easy to find if you put it in your GPS and you look it up online, the Apple Pan. But I'll tell you, the menu is not elaborate, but you go there for the cheeseburgers. And ironically, you go there for the pies. It's called the Apple Pan. It's, you know, and you go there for the fries. I mean, great fries. But I had this double cheeseburger, and they have some kind of their own sauce, some hickory sauce. Whew. Oh, my gosh. Was it good? And they give it to you. They give you the hamburger in one of those, like, white parchment paper. So you eat it out of the parchment paper, and you have to, because the thing is so juicy that you have to, or your hands will just get, you know, just filled with the juice of the hamburger and the cheeseburger and this delicious sauce. And it's stacked high. It's got lettuce and tomato and onion and mayonnaise plus this this other sauce. Oh, my gosh. So good. And the cool thing is, when you order, the waiter who's got the little white little kind of cardboard paper hat, you know, he comes up and take your order, and you order, you know, cheeseburger and fries. And before the fries come, he takes a little plastic plate out, and he, and this must be something that they do at the restaurant, he pours the ketchup for you. So there, he takes out this little plate, and he gives the Heinz ketchup bottle like three or four shakes. And the fries aren't even there yet. But he's preparing you for your fries. I'm sitting there going, how does he know I like ketchup on my fries? He could be wasting their ketchup. What if I don't use the ketchup? But this must be the thing they do. So he just, you know, my wife ordered the fries too. We each got an order. So he takes this little thing, and he takes about three shakes. And I think they're only allowed three shakes of the ketchup. But they prepare your fries with this ketchup. So they give you the shakes of the ketchup, and then the fries come, and then the cheeseburger comes, and my gosh, was it great. And then you get, they have like three or four different pies, which they bake, and you see them right there baking them in the place, in this other window. And we had the apple pie a la mode. We just shared one. Oh my gosh, was it good. The Apple Pan in Los Angeles on Pico Boulevard. If you're in L.A., I got to tell you, you will not be disappointed. And the other place is a very famous hot dog place in Los Angeles called Pink's, P-I-N-K-S. And all the celebrities go there, and it's been around once again since the 30s, I think. And that's on La Brea, which is another major street. It's kind of closer to the downtown area, or not the downtown area, but the Hollywood and Vine area, where it's very touristy there. But Pink's has been there, like I said, since I think the 30s or 40s as well. And you hear about some of these legendary places all the time. Oh, and, you know, I'm not a huge hot dog guy. I like hot dogs. I'm not crazy about hot dogs. But I said, you know, I've been to L.A. so many times. I've never been to Pink's. I've got to go to Pink's. So we went to Pink's one day, and there was a line, and there's a whole specific way to order. It's just like when you go to the Soup Nazi on Seinfeld. There's a specific way to order at Pink's. But regardless of that, and there's a long line, you do have to wait. But I'll tell you, I got the 9-inch stretcher chili cheese dog at Pink's. 9 inches. It's much bigger than the bun, so it sticks out on each side of the bun, which is cool. They pile on the chili. They pile on the shredded cheddar cheese and onions as well. And the hot dog has that crunch, you know, the crunch that the hot dog, a good hot dog, supposed to have. It's not a wimpy hot dog, folks. It has that perfect crunch. I have to tell you, I didn't want to finish eating it. And the fries were good there too. I did not want to finish eating it. And I was like, you know what? This is one of those places that's been around forever. And a lot of times you hear about these classic places and these vintage places and, oh, they're so great, and they're so great, and you go there, and you go, eh, no big deal. No, no. Pink's on La Brea in Los Angeles lives up to its legend and lives up to its hype. Jim Toronto here at WGN, 720 AM. Been filling in for Nick DiGilio. Started here at 1 AM, and we're almost here at the 5 o'clock hour. And as I said before, I was here yesterday morning, here today. And if you like what you've heard for the last couple of days, I hope you'll tune in tomorrow from 1 to 5, as I will be filling in for Nick DiGilio as well. So if you like what you heard, come back tomorrow at 1 a.m. If you're an insomniac, or you've got a crying kid that wakes up at 2 or 3 in the morning, or just like to listen to the radio all by yourself, you know, when no one else is listening, whatever your reason, we're glad you're here and appreciate you tuning in, texting, and phoning throughout the show today. Hope you had a good time. I'm looking at my little list here, and I do want to mention another thing. So when I was in Los Angeles, I told you some two. I'll give you another recommendation of a place to eat in Sacramento. Now, this place is a little nicer. This is a white tablecloth kind of place. So the other two I gave you, Apple Pan and Pink's in Los Angeles, those are, you know, kind of sit-down places, hamburgers, hot dogs, pie and stuff. So that's the kind of diner kind of feel. But this place is a place called Capo, C-A-P-O, Italian restaurant. Yes, a little on the pricey side, a little more than I expected, to be honest with you. But I have to say, I had a rigatoni dish. You know, just as probably like rigatoni bolognese. So it's kind of like, you know, pasta dish with a meat sauce, a little creamier. But I have to say, they prepared this pasta. You know, pasta, when it's made right, is supposed to be al dente, which means it's a little harder. It's not supposed to be real loose or soft. It's supposed to have a little bite to it, not a crunch. That's raw. But just a little tough, al dente. I have to say that this place made al dente. They defined al dente. It was some of the best. I mean, because, you know, pasta, it can be pasta when you order it. I mean, it is what it is, right? But not only was the bolognese sauce excellent, but the way that they made this pasta, it's one of the best, you know, cooked pastas, just cooked perfectly. So I have to give a shout out. A little expensive, more expensive than I expected. So if you're going there, just realize that it might be a little, you know, it's pricey. But I'll tell you, the food certainly, you know, lived up once again to its reputation. And I say this because, as I say, we watch these shows, you know, with these different restaurants. And so about 12 years ago, we're watching Food Paradise, right? And I think it was about fried foods. And so they're talking about the good old southern delicacy, in quotes, of chicken fried steak, right? It's like a flank steak, a very thin steak that is basically, you know, put with, you know, breading on it, and it's fried. Chicken fried steak, right? So, I mean, it looks really interesting and good. And there is this place in a town just outside of Houston called Tomball, T-O-M-B-A-L-L, Tomball, Texas, about a half hour or so out of Houston. And this place was called Goodson's. And they claim to have the greatest chicken fried steak in Texas. And they were huge. And they're showing them, you know, how they're dredging them in the flour, and then they're putting them in the fryer, and they pull them out, and they're these giant things. They're huge. They're bigger than the plate. And then, of course, they give you all the fixins. You know, they've got the mashed potatoes with that thick kind of brownish-gray gravy with the herbs in it. You know what I mean? Oh. And they have these huge, delicious biscuits, and they had these really big green beans, and I'm just watching this thing. And I'm like, I've got to taste this. I've got to go to Goodson's in Tomball. But I, who goes to Tomball in Texas, right? So, you know, I'm always thinking something, all roads lead to Elton John with me, right? That's why I'm called Elton Jim. So I said, well, I'm going to wait, and hopefully Elton goes to Houston one time, and we'll go see Elton in Houston, and then we'll have a reason to go to Tomball and get this chicken fried steak at Goodson's. And at one time we were on this one vacation and we met some people and they said they were from the Houston area. And I said, do you know Tomball? And they said, oh yeah, we know where Tomball is. I said, oh, have you ever heard of Goodson's? And they're like, yeah, you know, and they didn't think it was any big deal, but I was like raving about this Goodson's and Tomball, Tomball. So for a good 10 or 11 years, I'm just Tomball, Tomball, Tomball. And every so often they would rerun this, this show on the travel network, you know, fast food, you know, fried paradise, whatever it was. And I'd see Goodson's and I'd see this chicken fried steak and all those fixins with it. And so finally, the stars aligned about 2 or 3 years ago and Elton John was performing in Houston. So I said to my wife, okay, we got to go to Houston and we got to go to Tomball. So we go to Houston, we rent a car, drive half hour out, and there is Goodson's. And it was like I heard angels. It was like a choir of angels. Finally, I was finally in Tomball. I was finally at Goodson's, and I was finally going to have this chicken fried steak that I had been salivating over for a good 10 years. And I'm not exaggerating. It was at least 10 years, if not more. We walk into the place about 2 in the afternoon. And it looked like it looked. I mean, it's not a fancy place at all. Very kitschy, you know, tablecloths with the red and white, squares on them. This is not high living, high dining. This is, once again, kind of comfort food place, you know. And it's in rural Texas. So, you know, a lot of kitschy stuff on the walls, wooden floors. That's what it is, you know. Just a very everybody's in jeans and cowboy boots, and flannel shirts. Just very casual, it's like, it would be like a place like Omega, one of those kind of, 24-hour places that sell sandwiches and eggs and breakfast, all that with those 58-page menus. Only this is in Texas, and they sell, and their specialty is chicken fried steak. So I get there, and I order, the chicken fried steak with all the fixings and that delicious, those mashed potatoes with that gravy and the whole thing. And I even tell the waitress, we are from Chicago. We came here just for this chicken fried steak. And she looks at me like, and she even said this, which I got a little afraid. She's like, you came all the way to Chicago to come here? And I was like, well, that's not very good PR for your, I hope your boss didn't hear that. But I'm like, okay, no problem. So finally it comes. And it is big as advertised. And there's these beautiful rolls, and there's those mashed potatoes with that brown and kind of gray gravy with the herbs in it, and there's the green beans, and I can't wait because I haven't eaten from the night before. I am like, I am going to be hungry. And so my wife ordered something else. She didn't want the chicken fried steak. And so I get the knife and the fork, and I make the cut, and I stick the fork in, and I take a bite, and I'm chewing, and I'm chewing, and I'm chewing, and you know what? It wasn't all that great. I was so disappointed. And I tried another bite, and I tried like 3 or 4 bites, and then my wife looked at me, and she goes, so? And I go, it's not that good. I was so disappointed. And I was so gun-shy from then on to go to these places that we'd seen on television because I'm like, is this going to happen again? Because I literally traveled to Houston for this chicken fried steak. Yes, I went to see my Elton John concert, which was great. But the real impetus to even getting off the couch and going to that concert in Houston was because I wanted to go to Tomball and get this chicken fried steak. And it really was just okay. It wasn't worth the trip, and I was very disappointed. So I'm happy to say that when I went to the Apple Pan, which I saw on television in Los Angeles, and when I went to Pink's, which I saw on television, I've heard about for many years, that food exceeded my expectation, and it was worth the hype, and it was worth the legend. So I just want to say, you take, the good with the bad. Sometimes you hit a home run. Sometimes you hit a ground ball to the pitcher. Goodson's was a ground ball to the pitcher. Pink's in the Apple Pan, definitely home run, if not grand slam. So there you go. So it is almost 5 o'clock here. It's time for me to leave. I'll be here tomorrow from 1 o'clock. I appreciate you listening. I hope you stayed with me the whole time. Thanks to those who called in. Thanks to those who texted. And once again, we're going to be here tomorrow at 1 a.m. to do it all over again one more time.